This week's Shockwaves is brought to you by Wellgo USA. They have two amazing titles releasing the Steelbook this month. First is Phantasm Remastered. Phantasm Remastered is now available in a limited edition Steelbook Blu-ray with new bonus footage from director Don Coscarelli. Yes, Phantasm is now available in HD thanks to the meticulous restoration of J.J. Abrams and his Bad Robot team. Follow Mike, Jody, and Reggie as they embark on what is to be a long, nightmarish journey in the face of evil in lush 4K. Hurry before they're dead gone. Also releasing from Wellgo USA, the record-breaking international smash hit Train to Busan is now available in a limited edition Steelbook Blu-ray with many new bonus features. Simple trip to Busan for his daughter's birthday turns into a fight for survival as Suk-woo and his daughter Su-an find themselves trapped on a suspicious-filled, blood-drenched bullet train to a safe zone, which may or may not still be there. Hurry before this zombie train has left the station.
Today's episode of Shockwaves is sponsored by Diabolik DVD, featuring demented discs from all over the world. Check them out online at www.diabolikdvd.com. They're the number one source for horror, cult, and strange films from around the world. The company is movie buff owned and operated. If you're looking for rare, unique, and strange films, then you need to head on over to Diabolik DVD. They're constantly updating their inventory and have plenty of movies that you won't find anywhere else. They recently revamped their website, and ordering has never been easier right now on Diabolik. They have the exclusive all-region Blu-ray of Death House, which has been called the Expendable of Horror, starring genre legends Adrian Barbeau, Barbara Crampton, Bill Moseley, Debbie Rochon, Dee Wallace, Felicia Rose, Gunnar Hansen, Kane Hodder, Michael Berryman, Sid Haig, and Tony Todd, all in one movie. They also have an all-region Blu-ray of She-Borg. An alien fugitive crash lands on Earth and begins turning people into cyborgs that feed on animal flesh. Dylan and her best friend Eddie have to team up to stop the She-Borg before the whole town is assimilated into monstrous machines of destruction. So, for all your horror and cult cinema needs, head on over to www.diabolikdvd.com. Or find them on Facebook. I know I'll be ordering extra from them very soon.
Okay, welcome to episode 121 of Shockwaves. Almost the whole gang is here. Almost.
And really, this was a close call for a couple of us.
And most
yeah,
of
yeah, some of us almost didn't make it tonight.
They're all dying except for me.
Rob is literally
but you almost died today. So it's like you actually almost died and then the rest of us
nice either or fair, but it's true. Hey, Rob Galuzzo here, Elric Kane, Rebecca McKendry.
Hello.
We call ourselves survivors.
Survivors.
We're fine old people. You know,
this is pretty fun.
We survived the Halloween season.
Yes.
Which, quite frankly, is threatening to kill us every year.
Totally bonkers.
And Elric and I made it through, but with some type of plague. So literally, are sitting at one end of the table. Yeah. Hi, Elric. How you doing? Sipping our tea and lemon.
Yeah.
And Rob is at the other end of the table, kind of waving at us.
In a big spacesuit thing.
Listen, I started this morning by getting rear-ended. Literally, no accidents in my 10 years in Los Angeles, and now two in the span of a month, neither of which were my fault. I ain't taking chances anymore. So you guys are at that end of the table. I'm here.
Well, I think the coincidence that both times the person who hit you was Ernie, our sound guy. Like Ernie's just always following us around. You got to back off, Ernie.
No,
that's
it was not. It was not Ernie. Okay. Ernie's a saint.
Slander?
It was not him. But yeah, so we're all here. Ryan couldn't make it at the last minute, but I think he's back next week.
He'll be back next week. I talked to him, and he is back with us next week. So
you may have the whole team
we'll
back.
We'll have everybody. It's going
to
be crazy.
It'll be perfect chance for me to talk about Halloween then.
Yeah, finally. Yeah. You've been waiting for him? Or?
No, I probably should wait till he's back.
Yeah.
That's fine. Let's see. Where should we begin? Well, why don't you tell us about let's talk about our Halloween, because we haven't really, you know, right before the last show that I remember recording was right before Elric, you went to the Knoxville Film Festival.
My God.
We were at the Halloween 40. Last time that like we all
were together. And believe it or not, even though that aired on Halloween, that was actually mid-month.
Yeah.
So we haven't been together since then. So let's play a little catch up. I mean, Becca, you're doing a movie, so did you get to enjoy Halloween at all?
Barely. So I rolled off the movie. It was 3 weeks on the movie, which was absolutely an incredible experience. I got to stab somebody in the neck with knitting needles, even though that this is, because this is, a made for TV movie, they don't call them horror on this particular channel. They call them domestic thrillers, but the body count in this one is like way higher than in anything else I've ever shot. So I beat somebody to death with a tea kettle. I got to stab somebody in the neck. neck with knitting needles. It was a trip. But then, yeah, I had, I rolled off of that. And the day after we wrapped, I did my Miskatonic lecture on aquatic horror. So I had that.
That was really cool. She won't say it, but I got to say, that was like, 'cause we do the show with her every week and hear her talk about aquatic horror, but I've never seen the deep dive. The deep dive wasn't just movies. It was like maps and cartography and photos from her childhood. I mean, it was, and a lot of creatures that I did not know existed. And now I'm way more terrified of the deep.
Yeah, no, there's scarier creatures in the ocean than in movies.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It was really interesting. And it was just, I think these deep dives are kind of curious.
Well, thank you, Elric. Yeah, I had a blast with that. It was literally 3 hours of me kind of exploring the public fascination with aquatic horror, our fear of the ocean and everything that dwells within and why it's mostly justified. And then how that spun into maps, cartography, how it influenced the development of civilizations to a certain extent, folklore, things like that.
And then lots of deep rising.
There was only two deep rising slides. Yeah, Elric ran a clip for me. So I had that, and then I did not get to do much for actual Halloween. I went to the Disney Halloween celebration, which was just a blast. Like, they redo the entire park. They changed the Haunted Mansion over to the Nightmare Before Christmas. Yeah. So the whole thing was just an absolute blast. Mickey dresses up like a vampire. Wow. And then I, because I'd been on set for a couple of weeks, and by that time I was sick, I watched a shit ton of movies, which I'm excited to talk about.
Well, I think there's one that we all saw, so we should probably kick off with that, which was the Shudder original or acquisition, Terrified.
So
Argentinian
good.
Horror.
Yes.
Don't you have Argentinian blood, or are they Italian?
I do have family in Argentina, yes. My brothers were born there.
There's only the guy who made, what is that? He's made three films recently. As far as I know of Argentinian horror filmmakers, only that guy who did that one that's set on this. It's on the night of the day of the eclipse, and they run Satan worshippers. Do you know that one I'm talking about?
I don't.
Penumbra, I think it was.
Oh, I have seen Penumbra. It's been a couple of years.
And Cold Sweat. That director.
Oh, I really liked Cold Sweat.
He's Argentinian. So
is the Plague of Zombie movies. Okay. I believe those are Argentinian.
And I'm sure there are others, but I've always been, because I went down there once with my mom and kind of fell in love with Argentina, so I started always looking up what kind of movies. But this movie, what a gem. Though somebody posted on my tweet about it when I said how good it was, saying this was the most disappointing thing I've seen all year. I was I guess we're watching different movies.
Wow, everybody when I posted up, everybody was like, holy shit, this was so scary. This freaked me out. This destroyed me tonight. No, Terrified was a fun treat for me, where there was one night, I don't even remember what we were talking about, but Elric had mentioned to me that he was watching Terrified that night. And I was, as soon as I started Googling it, I was like, wow, this looks amazing. And so I watched it, and going in knowing nothing about it, except it's supposed to be scary as shit. And literally, the movie never really explains itself. So even if I'd read stuff about it, I don't think it would have destroyed the movie for me, because it never really explains what's going on. You're just kind of put into this situation, and then all of this crazy ass shit happens.
Yeah, it's definitely dread mood inspired. But the little, I described it as like Yuzna-like set pieces, because they have these really good body horror, practical effect payoff moment gags that people just aren't doing that much. And each one was really, really good. And there's one of the, the key item they show is this like old man looking demon, but that's not the scariest part. The part in the film is this little boy thing.
The little boy thing is
feels like out of the cemetery.
I would have said like the crazy twisted torso person.
That's the Yuzna part.
And it's so brief. And I was like, man, that is like old school horror for me, where you construct that amazing appliance and you just use it for 5 seconds. But that became one of my most memorable moments.
It stands out. I think so. Yeah. I mean, we don't want to give much away, but basically it's a Spanish movie that's got a slight supernatural bend, basically on a certain block.
Yeah.
And so what's interesting about it, I didn't even think of it this way. I dare to use the word anthology, because it's not really. Mm-mm. But when you said set pieces, because basically it's some like set pieces that take place on the same block, like one where we start with the movie, and then the neighbor, and then how the neighbor connects to the little boy.
Well, it has POV, so it almost
feels
like that.
Yeah. And so it almost feels like this weird like anthology about this really odd supernatural presence on this block, and seeing it from different angles. I loved it. I liked it because it sets up just scary stuff. Mm-hmm. I can understand why people might be disappointed in, because when it ends, and it ends kind of abruptly, if I remember correctly,
it does.
I was hoping or waiting for an element to bring it all together. like, okay, here's why, or, you know, how all of these things connect. That's not really there, and that's fine. Yeah. You know, like something like Ghost Stories, for example, is all these different spooky stories that then have
very cleanly.
Something that tie together, and I don't really like the way they tie together, but at least I appreciate that's there. So that's the interesting thing is, like, you know, people that don't like the way it works in Ghost Stories, here they don't do that, and people don't like that. So I don't know.
Yeah, the second it ended, I was like, okay, because I haven't seen many films where I'm like, oh, I'd remake that tomorrow. But this one, this year, because it was like, oh, all you really need to do would be you'd make it a single protagonist lead, and you would make it, just give a little bit more about what they're doing. I don't even mean what the creatures are. I mean, the people kind of investigating it. I want to know a little bit more about that.
Supernatural investigators.
Exactly. And I think that the main cop that you see, he becomes the protagonist, but the last 30 minutes of the movie, and then you stay with him. But I would say that if you'd made him the protagonist through the whole thing, it would have seemed like more of a through line instead of him just showing up and then suddenly taking control of the camera.
Yeah. But in terms of the gags, it's the best gags of the year. Like, so far, like, each one of these little bursts are just so much fun.
Oh, yeah.
And definitely one of the creepier moments of the year with this little boy thing. That's all I'll say about it. But it's just also interesting. Like, I was, like, continually going, oh, what is this?
Yeah.
And then it doesn't give it all away. So you're kind of left with going, what is this, a little bit, which could go either way. But
there were also a couple of moments that I rewinded to see them again because I was like, what the fuck did I just see? And then I'd, where the girl's head breaks. Not giving much more detail than that. That was one that I was suddenly like, holy shit, what the hell? Yeah. And I had to rewind it back to see what had grabbed. And yeah, there was a lot of really good
stuff. I'd be shocked if this one isn't Shockwaves approved, but I guess we have to wait for
Ryan. Three out of four makes it officially Shockwaves approved, doesn't it? Oh, no, that was our top 100.
Yeah. No, I think to be truly approved, you have to have all four of us.
Well, right now it's a good contender, correct?
Yeah.
I think so.
Because we all love it. Terrified, it's on Shudder right now as a Shudder exclusive. You should check that one out. And Elric, talking about your Halloween, tell us about Knox.
Knoxville is one I've been promising. William Mahaffey runs this new cinema they built called Central Cinema. Me and Beck have been on their jury.
Judged
the last couple years, and he's wanted all of us to come down to do Shockwaves for a few years. And I'm always impressed by, you know, for a small town, the quality of shorts he's getting. And this year, I was just like, you know what, I really want to go there. Because I really liked, we were in Chattanooga earlier this year, and
we had a great time there.
Had a blast there. Maybe I had a little bit too much of a blast.
Hey, I cleaned up your vomit.
I did not go that direction on this trip. There wasn't a lot of drinking, but it was fun. And me and the other judges, we were all like living in his house. So that was kind of quirky and funny at the end of the night. Everyone was staying in the same place. A lot of bad snack food was eaten, that kind of thing. But the Central Cinema is this little cinema, micro cinema that they created. It was also some of the events were at a main cinema too. But so the first couple things that come to mind was, and I'll rush through most of these quickly, I got to introduce Zombie, a 4K, to everyone. And I found myself giving a Stanley Kubrick analogy to introduce Fulci, and I think this will be my most proud moment. And it all just came to me just before I got up. I'm like, yeah, I'm going to put this in a context that will make Fulci, and I'll try to paraphrase it, but it goes back to this. I met the bartender from Shining back in the day, and he had told me an analogy about working with Stanley, and he ended this long story that I won't tell here, but I did tell live by saying, so Stanley wasn't the greatest director, but he was the finest director, like a fine linen suit. And then I just took a break and I was like, so Fulci isn't the finest director, but he is the greatest. And I was really proud of that play to get Fulci out in there. So then everyone watched Zombie. It looked freaking amazing.
Yeah.
Like, really. And the fear of this and people going, oh, but I bet like Maniac's going to look gross. No, they both look beautiful. And it makes both of them so much better. Like Maniac even more so in a sense. Zombie, the last like 25 minutes is kind of unparalleled to me. It's such good filmmaking and just interesting zombie stuff. But man, Maniac really went to, that was also in 4K and just looked astounding. And that film's still really powerful and quite shocking. That ending is still pretty rough. Mm-hmm. And then I'll just run through some features to put them on your radars. Some will be festival-y, so you might not get to see them, but some are right around the corner. You know, the film that won the overall award in the end, the audience award, was Anna and the Apocalypse.
Yeah.
This is a complete crowd pleaser. I was smiling from ear to ear the whole film. I'd put it in that Shaun of the Dead, not because of the zombies, but just that feeling that you got watching Shaun of the Dead. It's that fun.
There's one scene that's very reminiscent, but the way they do it here is just so good.
It's just, and the songs are great. It was just so good to see this with a crowd. This is a crowd film, and probably the best crowd film I've seen this year. you're just like getting a crowd into it and the musical. I thought it was super fun.
And the music was good.
The music's
that's
good.
The big,
the
that's a big, yeah.
Yeah.
Your songs have to be really good.
Oh, yeah. It feels like seeing the cast of Glee in a horror movie, which is kind of what could happen. The Man Who Shot Hitler and then Bigfoot.
Hey.
Really liked this
one.
Yeah. This one was up there for best performance for me. You know, it was like when we were doing the awards, Sam Elliott. This is not really a horror film.
Nope.
So it doesn't really necessarily suit the festival in the same way, but it's, man, it's a sad, like it's one of those ones that a lot of people, there was a lot of tears in this movie at the end. It's really well made. It definitely
transcends
its
budget. Considering the title, isn't it interesting the type of movie you get with it?
And you get both these things. He does, in fact, kill Hitler, and he does, in fact, kill Bigfoot.
So it does
spoilers,
deliver.
It delivers on both those things very, very well. But then there's all this other stuff with him and his brother, and kind of reminded me of The Straight Story by Lynch, that kind of emotional connection you get between brothers. It's a really good film, just as a good movie. You know, it fits in a little less well than some of these things in terms of this, but I really liked it. So kudos on that release. There's a fun indie that was like total indie, bare bones indie called Sadistic Intention that had our buddy Jeremy Gardner in it. His partner Taylor Zadutki won an acting award for their Eric Penikoff, who's a listener of the show, listens. And this is like a micro budget, kind of in the vein of The Battery kind of budget, probably a little more, but all set in a house, very much in the metal world. A metal drummer showing up to a house to hook up with his buddy to do some practice, and then this girl's also showing up to get drugs, and then the two of them are left to kind of get to know each other. And there's a period in this movie, it's about 20 minutes, that is more like watching a romantic comedy, and that's the part I found myself drawn to more than the horror film, because I was just like, what a weird like section to have in a movie, and I found it compelling. The one that steals the show, and this is such a surprise, when I looked at this lineup, and this is the movie I want to put on everyone's radar. This movie got our Best Performance Award. This was coming out from IFC. I'd never heard of it. And every one of us completely uniformly agreed this was the best movie in the festival. It's called The Clove Hitch Killer.
Hmm.
And Dylan McDermott, this is the movie that you wanted, and I sure as shit wanted, Summer of 88 to be. I was deeply disappointed by Summer of 88, and it's trying so hard to give you 80s aesthetics and 80s music and like that whole thing. Clove Hitch Killer is like, what if your dad, who's a Cub Scout leader, actually is this serial killer who hasn't been doing it for about 20 years and was the sadistic guy, and it's right in the fucking opening like 20 seconds that it's pretty much no mystery is held that Dylan McDermott is probably that guy. Like, so it's right. Like, there's no spoilers here. That's like, that's the assumption when you start watching this movie. And the kid trying to kind of figure this out slowly, and he's in a very religious household. This is a serious version, but it has a scene in the middle of this movie that's just like one of my favorite scenes of the movie, where you really see kind of behind the mask for a second. And it's one of those scenes, because there's so many movies like this. I Am Not a Serial Killer is a very good one.
Yeah.
But that's supernatural in a sense. It goes, this is one to put on your radar. The writing, directing, and acting is top notch. Definitely like one of the sleepers of the year for me so far. But Dylan McDermott is just so good in this movie. And I'm not a fan of him as an actor. I've always found him kind of, he's always playing swarmy asshole lawyer type. And in this, he gets to be kind of like, you know, good guy, family man, maybe something else. And it's a lot of fun to watch. And then buddy of mine, Kyle Kuchta, who worked at Jump Cut for a number of years, and Bill Fulkerson had a documentary called Survival of the Film Freaks. Mm. And it's a fun exploration of cult movies from the past, but also how cult movies are going to survive in the future in the digital age. And I was sitting there, and there was a giant Rob Galuzzo head hanging over me. And as you'll hear in the episode, we did a fun episode where we, you know, it was like a couple hours where we did our, you know, five movies that kind of made us horror movies with the other judges. And that's going to play, I think, Thanksgiving. We're planning on playing that. But when I introed that, I was like, you know, I'm the only one here, you know, thinking I'm the man. And then I'm like, but then Becca's shooting a movie. Ryan just made Halloween, and we just saw Rob on screen talking about this movie. And I was like, wait, maybe I'm like the loser now. Because I'm here. I shouldn't even be here. So that was kind of a sad intro, but that should be a fun episode coming up. But that's what we're – and a ton of shorts that I can't possibly go into right now. But there was – it was a good festival, and kudos to William Mahaffey, and kudos to – he's getting married in the next few days to other hosts. And they're going to come out here on their honeymoon. So we'll see them out in L.A. for a few days.
Oh, great. Oh, they got to come sit in on a show.
Yeah, if they can, I'd definitely be fun.
Very cool.
So that was a cool trip. Cool that small towns have such cool things happening across America, you know, horror-wise.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So, Rob, what else did you see? Did you do any at Beyond Fest?
Yeah.
But I guess you've talked about that since
Beyond
then.
Fest. Beyond Fest, we've talked about a little bit. No, I guess for Halloween Day, because basically by the time Halloween rolls around, I'm like so exhausted from running around and doing haunts and events and screenings. I just want to chill out and watch movies. And I don't know why, I just was in the mood. I did a triple feature of The Fog, followed by Halloween 2. The original Halloween 2, not Rob Zombie's, and culminating with Scream. Okay. And that was actually like a really cool...
Wait, was there any method to that madness?
No, I don't know. It was just literally those were the... Well, Halloween, because Halloween's been in our mind, and basically the new one is obviously like the new Halloween 2. And basically I'm like, you know what? But I love Halloween 2. Like, yeah. I love the alternate version from 1981.
I think that film's shot really well. Work on that film is really
good. Yeah, Dean Cundey does a great job in it. And also, I'm really fascinated because that has always been... Just growing up, my favorite of the Halloween movies, more so than the original initially, because when I was a little kid, that's the one that scared the crap out of me. And so I guess from the last several months of like pretending it doesn't exist, I missed it. And so for Halloween, I was like, I just want to watch that one. The Fog was just because I haven't seen it in a couple years, and it's always been one of Carpenter's best. And it's that type of film where if you go a year or two without seeing it, you're just always impressed by, again, Dean Cundey, again, shot beautifully.
Like atmosphere-wise, one of the best movies, period.
And I know they just did a 4K restoration, but I was just watching my original Blu-ray, and even that, when Scream Factory first put it out, was just spectacular. So that was the reason behind that. And then for Scream, again, I hadn't seen in a while. That was my girlfriend went to a Halloween double feature in France of Nightmare on Elm Street and Scream. Yeah. And so that inspired that. I was like, oh, you know what? Wes Craven, that's a great double bill. I haven't seen Scream in a while. And also, I've Scream to me now is the TV show. Like, I haven't watched the movies in a really long time. So anytime I think of Scream, I think of the TV version. Although I really need to revisit, I think we should all do this actually, is revisit Scream 4. Mm-hmm. Because my original, and I think I've said this on the show already, my original assessment of that movie was pretty disappointed.
Except for the first 5 minutes.
Yeah, there was the 5 minutes is cool, but there were things in it that I remember, basically because the whole marketing campaign for it was like new decade, new rules. I was expecting like commentary on the Saw movies and like found footage and all stuff, and they didn't really do that. They just kind of fell back into the kind of the tradition of what the other three movies were. But I completely forgot. I was having a conversation with somebody not too long ago saying like, that's yet again, Wes Craven was a decade ahead. And then I thought about it. I'm like, oh, wait, like mild spoiler alert, but kind of the motivation was Tragedy Girls. It's like to get internet famous and all that kind of stuff. And I was like, and I remember thinking at the time, that's just too far-fetched. That would never happen. I'm like, holy shit, Scream 4 is totally ahead of, like, it's basically somebody wanting to be an Instagram star.
But did you rewatch Scream 4?
No, I haven't yet. Okay, but I'm saying watching the first one has inspired me. And we should all rewatch 4.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And see how I feel about it. How did you feel about it when it came out?
Besides the opening, I thought the opening was super cool. And then I was like, what?
First 15 minutes, amazing. Yeah. And then I didn't like the rest.
And that's the thing. I think Wes Craven yet again was just too ahead of the game. So
actually, speaking of that, have you heard this? That somebody was saying there's a vault somewhere out there with cursed all the full directors.
Yep.
Really?
Man, I would love to see what
there
that
is
would
a cut
like.
Original cut of it. So
because you can tell watching that movie how cut up it is. Mm-hmm. You're just like, what happened to this movie? But it could be a cool movie. It wouldn't surprise me.
I would love it if somebody
there.
Would. You know, I don't know what you have to do to get the Dimension / Weinstein rights.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It was one of theirs. But that's possible now. So,
yeah, it's crazy.
Who knows? So that was Halloween. What did? What else do we have?
So I saw Climax, the new Gaspar Noé. Did you already talk about that one?
Because you might have mentioned it very briefly.
Yeah.
I was at the
same
screening as you.
So. Yeah. So I enjoy Gaspar Noé. It's hard to say you enjoy Gaspar Noé. I've experienced his films. I always find them fascinating to watch just because they always have such crazy shit in them that I've never seen before. I wanted more from Climax. I loved the concept of it so much. As soon as I realized that Gaspar Noé was making a dance movie, I was like, this is perfect. It's like he's literally making this for me. I wanted them to push it further. Most of the Gaspar Noé films have that moment where you're like, holy crap, I can't believe this is on screen and I'm watching it happen. And it leaves you with something that you're still thinking about days later. This one did not have that impact for me.
I think it has those moments, but it doesn't have the characters to care about those moments. Because Irreversible, you get to know them and then you see terrible things. In this, it's like, crazy shit's happening. This is a bonkers movie. When you look at the violence and the crazy, the thing is that you don't know who anyone is.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of crazy shit happening, I will say. None of it is quite at like Irreversible or some of the levels of some of his other films. But yeah, because we literally have like 10 different protagonists in it, it was so much crazy shit. It was like deafening to the point where I walked away not really remembering specific moments, if that makes sense.
Yeah, but there's passages where you're just like watching a camera just move through space doing crazy shit where you're like, this is interesting.
Well, even the dance sequences are like actually ridiculously impressive.
There's only one. They make it look like there's a whole bunch of dance sequences. There's only one dance
sequence. The big opening.
It opens with a good like 5 minute like choreographed dance. And then no one else dances for the entire movie.
I think that's actually like 20 minutes, but I think it's longer than we think, but who knows? But it was,
like you get
I was impressed by it. But no, she like knows dancing. I don't know dancing. I'm watching it.
I don't either. And I'm like, how did they even pull that off?
It's club dancing. So it's they were voguing and things like that. Like it was definitely
that's a different
club
podcast.
Dancing stuff.
Becca's dance podcast. I want to see that podcast.
When I was reading reviews, people were like, it's very ballet. It's not in any capacity. No, it's total like club dancing. But you get like your dance sequence up at the top where they're there to do a rehearsal and they're getting ready to leave on a tour of the US. And so they do their like final dress rehearsal up at the top. You get like a 10-minute dance sequence and then the dancing stops and then they begin a party. And that's when everything starts unraveling as somebody spikes the punch, which you learn in the trailer. So I'm not giving spoilers.
It's definitely the Vision of Hell type stuff that he's into. It definitely delivers those moments.
Yeah. I mean, that was funny because for me, and this is how I feel about every Gaspar Noé movie. It's a one shot deal for me. I can only watch the movies once. And I was actually like kind of optimistic and like, oh, this is pretty cool. Like I like the vibe. Yeah. It's, you know, it's really well orchestrated. And then like there's this thing that happens in the movie, which isn't really a spoiler, but basically there's credits in like the middle.
Which I thought was the end. And I would have been like, this is such a cool movie. It just ended. This was so quick and fun.
It was like, this is the shortest, happiest movie Gaspar Noé's ever made because there's credits out of nowhere. You're like, all right, that's pretty cool.
And then it kept going.
And then there's like another 45 minutes of pure hell. Yep. And you're like, oh my God, I can't.
But I also think seeing it with an audience, I mean, seeing it at home, I would have taken it seriously. Uh-huh. Seeing it with the audience was nice because having Brian Collins two seats net, he was on the other side of Becca, cackling. You actually left at one of the funniest, because there's this little kid.
Yeah.
But if I was watching at home, I would just take that straight, like really dark, like, oh my God. But in a theater, people were laughing at the times you shouldn't, the most blackest moments.
Yeah.
And I really appreciated that.
I came back in and Brian Collins leaned over and explained the scene to me as only Brian Collins can.
It was kind of
great. And it was hilarious. Yeah. So I still, though I have not seen that scene because my bladder would not last for the entire movie, I only can envision what Brian Collins described, which was hilarious.
I'll be curious. I mean, it's A24, right? The pickup. So I mean, I'll be curious. It's not obviously, like all his films, it's not a big release, but this one's a little, I would say, less narrative than his even previous ones. So.
But it's weird because he's definitely gotten more kind of festival acclaim with this one.
Oh, yeah, no, he won an award at Cannes, which I was surprised.
I think it's more vanilla for him.
Maybe,
like, when you know,
well, it's shorter.
As vanilla as he can get, but trust me, that's not by normal.
I mean, Enter the Void is like a good 2 hours, 40 minutes or something, but it's an amazing piece of work. But I mean, weirdly enough, I'm kind of like you, Rob. I have not revisited, I've probably seen Irreversible maybe two or three times, and I've seen I Stand Alone maybe twice, but the rest I've seen once.
Once on those once as well.
But it's structural, for me, with him. It's like his technique. He's really an interesting filmmaker. It's the material that makes it hard to rewatch. Mm-hmm. But his actual filmmaking I find totally fascinating because he's very influenced by Kubrick, but he also likes to let the camera then at a certain point just roam and do its own thing. I find it really interesting. You know, I Stand Alone, I still think it's one of his most interesting films, and that's the most horror. So if people listening haven't checked out his first film, that film is really fucked up. I mean, that really disturbing movie.
The Dead Ringers screening with David Cronenberg was incredible.
You're giving everyone a flashback from like a month ago.
I know, right?
So old news.
I'm so old news, so I won't dwell on that one. I'll just say it was really incredible. And then I'll touch on this one briefly. Light as a Feather, I've been watching that show on Hulu, which I know Ryan spoke about a couple of weeks ago. I am loving it. It is like everything that I wanted the Scream Queens TV show to be, where it's a group of high school students, something supernatural. It's a slower build, and I'm just really enjoying it. I find the characters compelling.
I'd never even heard of this title until you said it a couple days ago.
Yeah, it popped up on...
Had you heard of it?
Well, just because Ryan had mentioned it.
It was on my Hulu recommendations. Like, when I log into my Hulu, I get, like, the stuff that I regularly watch. And then down at the bottom, it'll say like, we also recommend. And it was there. And so I watched the first episode because it's only like a half an hour
but
long.
But you mean Hulu, the channel that doesn't have a Shockwaves show anymore?
That one.
So
that's
there.
The
so,
one. I mean,
let's be honest. Let's all desubscribe.
Right. Yeah. Rights ran out on those.
Light as a feather. It's definitely, it feels very kind of Riverdale-ish in kind of the way that the horror is being presented and the way that the high school is being presented. So I'm enjoying it. So light as a feather.
A little indie one, recommendation of the Shudder. I don't know if you, you've seen this one, that I'd heard about at the same time I heard about Terrified is Witch in the Window.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I think, Beck, didn't you, was it you or?
I was talking about that when we were at the circus on Saturday that I wanted to see it.
She hadn't seen it yet, though.
Oh, yeah. Then it must have been Ryan. Ryan talked about this from a festival a couple months ago on the show saying, yeah, you have to.
Actually, that might be where it first got on my radar because I've been looking for it and nothing came up. And then I was in my hotel in Seattle about a weekend ago where I was for a different festival and it popped up that it was going to play that night and then the next day it was going to go on Shudder. I was like, oh, cool. This is a really kind of small, and I mean small, like intimate movie. It's really just a dad and his son. His son's been sent to him because he's been kind of, he did some naughty stuff on the internet and he's only like 12 or something. And the mom and dad are having problems. They're kind of separated, kind of, you're not sure where things lie. The dad's going to flip a house and like alter this house in the middle of nowhere and his son comes with him. And very simply, they see a witch in the window. They see an old woman in the window. And the movie, the horror stuff, there's a couple really nice horror beats, but there aren't that many horror beats. But the character stuff's really nice and gentle and kind of compelling. It's definitely a small film, perfect for Shudder, perfect way to see it, not to get, you know, overhyped. It's by the people, one of the directors of Yellow Brick Road and a couple other things.
Oh,
I liked Yellow Brick Road.
It's just, I think it's a really well-made movie. I wish maybe it could have... That when the couple scares happen, they work really well, and then it chooses, I think, to go, well, we're not trying to be just a scary movie. It's more about the character stuff. So I think they could have pushed that more if they wanted, but I think this was a choice. But yeah, I would definitely recommend it. I mean, I think Terrified's a bit more my thing, but I think they're both good, and it's cool to see Shudder getting such good content like and then popping it up. So you've just heard about it from festival, and you get to see it. But I liked it. I thought it was a good movie.
Very cool.
Excellent.
You
go. I'll catch up.
I've been catching up on some Blu-rays too because I mean we've been bombarded from every company that we know of, including the one that's coming in soon. So from Vestron Video, so Lionsgate is doing their whole Vestron line, and they've put out a bunch of cool stuff, including Parents and Slaughter High and all that. But the title that I checked out this week was Class of 1999, which I thought I'd seen, but I'd never seen this movie.
Is this like a post-apocalyptic movie?
Yes.
I remember the cover.
Now, it's the same. Okay, so I'm a huge fan of Class of 1984.
Well, and I always get them mixed up, but I watched 84 again recently for Pearson and really liked it. I was like, oh, what a cool script. Roddy McDowell.
Yeah,
really
Roddy fun. McDowell in it. Yeah. Tom Holland wrote it, directed by Mark Lester.
That's with the frog, right?
Is that in the Class of 94?
I can't remember.
84?
But the main punk, that blonde guy, who's like the worst of them, he's gone. He stopped acting and became like a major director.
Really?
I can't remember his name, but if you look him up, you'll go, oh, he's like a director we've all heard of.
Yeah.
Because he's so annoying in that movie. That's the preppy punk.
So Class of 99 is the same director. It's Mark Lester again. I always thought it was kind of a semi-sequel, but it kind of isn't. It's actually... just Mark Lester's attempt to remake it, but set it a little more in the future because, you know, even though it's 99, it came out in 90. So it was a few years before, but this premise and this cast is amazing. So basically it's kind of a post-apocalyptic, like basically like the way that RoboCop looks at 96 is being like decrepit and there's punks and criminals everywhere. So it's like they let out these juvenile criminals. One of them is like the kid Philip from Nightmare on Elm Street 3 that becomes the marionette. Uh-huh. So he's the lead guy and they let him out. And his brother is Joshua Miller, the little kid from Near Dark who now has become a screenwriter. And he goes to school. That's okay. So the principal of the school is Malcolm McDowell.
Oh, he's back?
Yes. You're thinking of Roddy.
Oh, right.
No.
Yeah,
Malcolm.
You're right. We went
Clockwork
to
Orange.
The two McDowells.
The principal is Malcolm McDowell, and he hires Stacy Keach to create these robot teachers that will discipline kids based on their programming.
Wait, does Keach have a ponytail or not in this? Because it's dangerous when he has a ponytail.
I don't know. I can't remember if he has a ponytail. I'm pretty sure he does. But he does wear these weird green contacts to change his eye color to make him look futuristic, if you will. So the robots that Stacy Keach creates are Pam Grier.
Whoa.
Who is the other one?
That's probably what I'd make.
Yeah, yeah. The principal from 3 o'clock High. And the last guy, was it Brad? Oh, no. But anyway, it is kind of insane and over the top. I mean, literally, because then it's like you got three robot teachers, Malcolm McDowell, Stacy Keach, a bunch of punk kids.
Cast, yeah.
There's all this, like these gang wars going on, and the teachers are they're basically a military program that's been repurposed to be teachers. And so they start like adapting, and they want to like pit the two gangs of kids against each other so that they'll all kill each other. It's pretty wild. And I actually had a lot of fun watching it. And it's also that weird period, in 1990 where they were still like spending money, and there's like tons of like stunts and explosions and crazy shit happening.
Wow.
So Class of 99 is actually a lot of fun. And apparently there's a Class of 1999 2, which was like
can't
a VHS.
They just keep moving through dates? And...
I know. No, apparently not. That's what I love when franchises do that. If you want to call this part of a franchise.
I want 2099. That sounds cool.
So Vestron put this out, and it is a blast. Total fun.
The person I was thinking of, the punk from Class of 1984, is Timothy Van Patten, who you would recognize because he's always the main episode director on Boardwalk Empire, Black Mirror, Deadwood. He did most of Deadwood's, I recall. Game of Thrones, The Pacific Rim, Sex and the City. So he's obviously The Wire. I remember always seeing his name on every TV show and go, oh, wow, that guy's good. And then I looked it up and I was like, and this is what he looks like now. He's like bald with a goatee.
Oh, wow.
And
that's the punk?
Yeah, that's the punk. And it's
from
like,
Class of 94.
And he pretty much stopped acting pretty early. And it's so cool that he ended up being successful in another way, because he's kind of bad as the punk, but you know, in a preppy punk kind of fun.
Yeah. Way. Yeah.
Well, we are going to wait to talk about a deeper dive into Suspiria.
Suspiria.
But we could give a little bit of our thoughts first, because me and Becca both seen it. Ryan was said for everyone to see it this weekend, but he isn't here, and you're going to see
it
tomorrow.
I'm going to see it tomorrow, yeah.
Nice.
So we'll save our whether it's approved or not for next week. But the reason I wanted to talk about it straight away was just in case people haven't seen it in theaters, because this strikes me as one of those movies you have no idea how long it will last. So
yeah.
I would want to encourage people to see it in theaters.
Yeah.
I'm sure it makes a lot more sense on a big screen.
I have a feeling that I appreciated it more in a theater than if I'd watched it in my living room.
Yeah, who knows? I don't know. It's cool. One of the things I like about this movie is I'm still processing some of it. I don't think it's all on the surface.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the first one wasn't, to be honest, for me either, because that was so wildly different when I was a kid. But the one thing I'll say about this movie, and I won't get into spoilers, but I made some notes because I was really struck by this afterwards, is it's not just the opposite of the original. I would actually go so far, it would be interesting to write about it, but I would call it the inverse of the original. So it is, in every single possible turn, it is the inverse of what the original is, which is such an interesting choice to make. So some of the things and these aren't really spoilers, but just so people understand. So rather than it being a fairy tale structure, which the original is, this is a political fable. Rather than discovering witches, which is what the first one, this one's from the POV of the witches.
Yep.
The whole movie.
Oh, wow.
You spend a lot of time with the staff in this one.
Yeah,
getting to know who they are, what they're up to, how it works. Like they do not cover that in any regard.
No, it's
like,
not.
You go
not
in
the interest,
knowing
yeah.
why they're looking for students.
The original is style over story, and this one is story over style. Like it's much more, they're trying to give you a lot of story beats that you're trying to kind of process and bring together.
Mm-hmm.
And there's still some really stylistic, but the style never dictates the movie.
Never.
Like the original. Mm-hmm. And the original is a single protagonist, and this it literally goes from this person is the lead for a while, now it's somebody else, which, you know, is a little dislocating, I'd say, probably the weakest thing for me about the movie, because I do really think that's one of the few structural things I think works in cinema, is having a single protagonist. But that creates a movie that isn't easily digestible in some ways, but I definitely, in the ride, I was really taken with it. I had no idea where each beat was going. I mean, it's set in, like, you know, 1978, German political stuff happened. The opening shot is like a political
bombing going on.
Which is not how you think of the original. Is just so set in a fairy tale land.
Yeah.
And this is like, boom, you're just in this very real world.
The landscape is really ugly in this one, whereas in the original, everything is so heavily stylized and meticulous.
And it's urban. This is urban.
Yeah, and this one, you feel like you're in the middle of a city landscape.
Yeah,
it's raining constantly. It is dreary. It is bleak. It is just bland looking and gray. And even inside the building, like there's a couple of stylish architecture touches. But when you think about the original Suspiria, you think about the architecture. This has none of that. It looks like a dance studio.
And the other big difference is what Argento uses the death scenes for is like they're all so operatic, the way they're pulled off, that they become like art pieces, even as disturbing as they are. And what Guadagnino does is they're all grotesque. There's no style to them particularly. It's like actually really over the top gore, and it's like disturbing and gory and but not like not beautifully put together. Most of it's in just juxtaposing the montage of editing.
Yep.
That's how he's creating his things. One early on, so I won't go into. I definitely won't go towards any of the end movie. But there's a really one of the best scenes is a kind of a dance kind of death scene that's really impressive. But again, it's never about the style of the director. It tends to always seem to be just laying on the berating the audience with the kind of painful suffering and gore, which is really different. And
and there's fluids, like it gets really fluid
heavy. Yeah, it's pretty gross.
Which it gets really gross. And when I watch Suspiria, you think, yeah, it is very operatic. Like the death scenes are just as beautiful as the rest of the movie. And
But what you're describing sounds like how Argento does violence to me. It always is a little extra oomph of pain. Like somebody's
he does that
tooth falling, like hitting a curb or, you know, like.
But it's all stylized. Mm. He's always got like that. It's also precise. Like that's why it seems to me he makes movies, right? Argento seems to be making the narrative so he can get to that set piece of the death where the woman's hung.
The gore, the violence pieces exist just for the gore, and they're shot for the gore. Like, it's not stylish. There's nothing, you're not looking at blood running in a particular manner down a leg or, you know, dropping through a window or anything like that. It's all very functional with a broken body on the floor.
It has lots of really stylish parts to the movie, but they don't tend to be those scenes. The violence is just violent and gory, whereas there's some cool dream scenes and stuff that are super creative. There's a lot of art to it. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to make it, but it's the opposite where the style isn't the story, which is what it is for Argento, and that's what's so interesting.
Well, okay, but so far both of you have just literally been telling me the differences between
right.
the two.
So,
as a movie, would it work for somebody that's never seen?
Yeah. It might work better.
How would somebody blindly go into this movie?
I would sell it like this. I think this is actually one of the best witch films ever made.
Yes.
This is a better witch film than Suspiria.
Completely.
It's not a better movie than Suspiria. Suspiria is a much more exciting experience for me. There's parts of this that don't work for me, but as a witch movie, I think it's like up. It's like you actually get to see witches discussing things, thinking about things. There's some really fucked up scenes that they do. You see hierarchy. I think it's a really fucking good
there's
witch
a battle
film.
For power within the witches. You actually get to see like the actual ceremonies at the end. You get to see why they're using the girls. I'm not giving spoilers. But no, it's whereas in the first one, it was a little confusing why the witches chose to run a dance school. That was just kind of like, they're witches, and they run a dance school. Is this for money? Do they just get bored on weekends? What's up with that? But this one, like, there's a function behind it of what they're trying to do. And you spend way more time with the witches and how the structures worked. And the movie actually opens into one of the witch meetings, so you know exactly what their motivations are from the get-go. And, it's a damn good witch movie.
Just a really interesting. It's really hard. I think it'll take a while before I know some people like this. Definitely seems to be a love it or hate it thing so far. Mm-hmm. Like I know people like Spencer. He's seen it five times. He runs Death Waltz, best film of the year by far, and he loves the original. And then some people hate it. I'm surprised somebody would hate it because it's such an interesting movie.
Well, it also sounds very dense. Like I don't really just say when you walk out, I hate or
the
like
political it, yeah. stuff is maybe a little more ham-fisted in there at times. But I understand it's really hard to talk about. I understand that is the allegory side of it. I just don't know if I know all of the pieces without researching.
It was also fascinating because it was focused on the witches. It was an all-female cast for the most part, aside from there's two detectives that come in at one point, but very briefly. Otherwise than that, it was an entirely female
cast.
Which
I think was a really interesting choice. Yeah, you don't have the blind piano player from the original or anything like that.
Yeah, none of that. Udo Kier doesn't make an appearance.
That's a shame.
It's just all females the whole time, which I've discussed with a couple people now is weird because it's bookended with the Thom Yorke song.
I enjoy
that song, but that you're led into this all-female cast and then led out by a male voice, it was a little weird.
That was actually the first thing that struck me was like, it's a really good score, but I was like, I don't know if I want to hear a guy at all in this.
Interesting.
It feels so feminine.
Yeah, I was going to say, because that's what I've already purchased the score, and I've been listening to a lot, and what I was impressed with is that it's – score by Tom York, but also that he actually wrote songs that are in there. And I'm like, oh, that's kind of interesting. So I have no context. The songs are gorgeous.
Yeah.
They're like, they're just, I like it better than some Radiohead stuff.
Yes, vocal tracks date something for me in a way because it's Radiohead dating it. Whereas when it's Johnny Greenwood just doing his scores, you know, there's nothing that can date that.
Yeah.
But it's still interesting. But I agree with you about hearing. I think if you're going to hear anything, it would have been like more modulated size of a woman's voice or something could have been cool. But it's, you know, it's interesting. But it's a movie I would definitely recommend. You know, I feel like I'll see it again. But like I said, I thought there's some really scary stuff, and it's a well-made movie. So
yeah, I have to give a graphic novel plug before we move on. Beauty, I read this week. This was actually recommended by a Shockwaves listener while we were in Texas. I read the first two volumes this week, and I've just ordered the third. Somebody had recommended it to me because I like Black Hole so much. And this is another graphic novel series about an STD. But in this one, the STD causes people to become absolutely gorgeous. Like fat cells melt away, cheeks restructure themselves, they become the most beautiful people in the entire world, like unnaturally gorgeous. And so, and the only symptom of it, it's a virus. But the symptom is that you kind of like always have a cold. Like you're always sneezing, you have a low grade fever, but for some people it's worth it.
Wait, is this the one where somebody like sneezes who's pretty and then they blow up?
Yes.
How did I know about that?
I don't know.
Have you talked about
it? I think
you
have.
Or have I seen
this? No, I just read this. I literally, this just arrived
somehow
in the mail.
Somehow this came on our radar because I've seen panels of this recently.
Yeah, it's very cool.
Like I saw someone on a subway sneezing and who looked beautiful.
That's
and then
it.
Blow.
That's
maybe
it,
Ryan.
Exactly. Maybe I think it was talked Ryan. About it. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh. Wait, this is how we don't even
our
know what the
are
other
so
people.
100 and some episodes, guys. So yeah, no,
it
this
definitely
is,
came up. Sometimes
it's a really cool one, and they've got a couple of volumes. And the book focuses well, at least the first volume focuses more on kind of the social outbreak that happens where people make this choice of like, I'm going to go out and get the disease because I want to be beautiful. And they call it the beauty. And they call the people who have it the beauties. And people will go out and get it. And then others are like, no, I don't want that. I'll stay dog ugly. And it becomes really clear in society who has it and who doesn't. And people will go out and seek it and want their children to get it and things like that. But it ultimately is a virus. And the movie opens when someone is going around committing these crazy bombings and deaths of the beautiful people. Hmm. And so then it becomes kind of a social thing of why would you do this? And so,
why do they explode if they sneeze? Because I understand they get a cold, but that seems a lot worse than a cold.
It's like a rigged I'll say – I don't want to blow – that is kind of a twist to it. So weird. I don't want to – I'll just say that someone is like
tampering
committing
with
terrorist
thing.
Acts against the beauties and
sounds
trying
fun.
To make a political message. But it's got a lot more to it than that.
Okay.
Yeah, it was a real fascinating read, so I recommend checking it out. That was the one from Image Comics.
Okay. I have some music and book recommendation. I mentioned this when I first got it. I got to mention it again. Don Coscarelli, who we know and love, wrote a book called True Indie. I started reading it a while ago. I just finished it a couple days ago. I absolutely love this book so, so much. And a big part of it is, you know, you never know what kind of format autobiographies and things of that sort are going to be. This one's so much fun because literally the entire book, which is a crap ton of chapters, every chapter is maybe 2-3 pages long and it's all anecdotal. And he goes chronological. So literally, it's like the uncle you love telling you a story in 5 minutes. Like, I just flew through it and I kept – I'd put it down so that I wouldn't finish it so fast because it was just one of those kind of reads. And I mean, it goes through warts and all of the successes, the amazing accomplishments, the failures, the really, really hard battles. I mean, there were things – I was telling Elric when we went out to that show this weekend.
We should plug Shapeshifter.
Which we will talk about next.
Oh, yeah, the Shapeshifter.
No, it's just – it's I mean, working in distribution myself now, it is depressing some of the challenges and things that Coscarelli's had to go through, considering, you know, the success he had with Phantasm, like things with Phantasm 2 and some of the sequels. He goes through the Silver Bullet chapter alone is kind of heartbreaking because, like, I think Coscarelli could have made an amazing Silver Bullet.
Yeah.
It's just really wonderful. And it also feels very, I don't know, it feels like you're reading about family. And what I mean by that is, you know, the last time they were all together, the Phantasm crew, we were there. We did a killer POV with them at Texas Frightmare.
I wonder if we're the last where they were all.
We were. Wow. That was the last time they were together was
you
Texas Frightmare.
You were
I
with
was.
Us.
I was.
Yeah,
stage.
And I mean,
and Angus.
There's parts of the book where he talks about that was the last time they were all together. And so, you know, it's, I just feel like we know all of Phantasm. We know we loved Angus and all that. But the last two chapters of this book made me cry because it's that kind of emotional journey. And it's just, if you have any interest in filmmaking or what goes behind it or just even a love of this kind of stuff. I mean, even all the Bubba Hotep stuff and trying to get that sequel off the ground and his disagreements with Bruce and all that stuff. It's a really incredible read. And it gets my strongest recommendation. I mean, he was on this show and it's still one of my favorite episodes. So check out True Indie by, Don Coscarelli.
Nice.
And yeah, let's talk about the show that we all got to see together.
Shapeshifter Circus, which we were invited to by Graham Skipper. His wife is the one who puts on the show.
Jordana.
And it was fun.
It was pretty bonkers.
We didn't know what we were getting into at all. Yeah. But there were carnival games as soon as we got there. And then so basically it's like a rock show, rock opera that involves gymnastics and kind of like rock music. And it sounds
like a lot of aerial work.
A lot of aerial
horror imagery, a really gory clown.
Yes. Puppetry.
Yeah.
Removing his head.
Yeah.
It was pretty wild. I mean, and we're in the front row, so the whole thing, and we had no idea. There was this great stilt work. I am always impressed
by there's
stilt
like a raven on a stilt thing. Yeah, it was pretty cool.
But it felt kind of dangerous. Like we're in the front row, and I'm kept looking up at the two dancers who are they? I don't even know what it's called.
Aerialists,
yeah. And when they're really high up and the ground's like concrete, and I just kept having this thing flipping through my head going, how fast will I be able to dive? And you're like, they don't need that. Look how strong. They're stronger. They could both bench press me. So, but it was really impressive on that level. So, yeah, I thought it was a cool thing. It was cool to do something different, too. Like, that's why I told Graham after. It's just cool to get out of it. We're just so used to just seeing movies and, you know, doing the things that we're comfortable with. This was an interesting, though I felt old at times. I was like, with the music, I was like, man, I feel old just because this feels so wild, you know?
Yeah.
But,
you're so lame, Elric.
It is because of me.
Well, if you want a taste of it, there's a website called shapeshiftercircus.com because the music is available. Like all the music that they did is available as a soundtrack. And as of now, the show's over. It was kind of intended for late October, early November.
Yeah, they did like a short run of it.
Yeah, and they've done it before in the past, but I guess the idea is to continue doing this sort of show and maybe do it, I think, monthly at some point. Mm-hmm. But yeah, if you're curious and you want to hear some of the music or see some of the video, you can check out the website.
And I'll also give a quick plug to the new Earbud Theater that went up, which Jared Rivett, who's been on the show before, was involved in and wrote. It's Tales from the Dead of Night. It's really Amicus. It's like an anthology series, and it really is kind of cool Amicus ghost stories. I listened to it on my long-ass drive to USC this morning, so it's really fun. Check it out.
And I have a message for one of our listeners.
Oh.
Eli, all is forgiven. You know who you are, Mr. Eli Roth. One of our
why is all forgiven?
All is forgiven because first episode of his horror history just pissed me off that Luke Fulci wasn't mentioned and a zombie, but Walking Dead was mentioned for 2 10-minute blocks.
Okay,
I mean it's AMC, so of course, but that really pissed me off. I've got to say, but the quality of the show is really fucking good. It's a great. I mean, it's the best horror history primer I've ever come across. Like, and I say primer because these episodes could be 3 hours. They're just scratching the surface with 1 hour, but then often focusing on say. Like the two slasher episodes I thought were fantastic. It often ends up settling on 2 to 3 titles, but then also showing clips of like the whole kind of history of that genre or subgenre. But they are great primers. And people being put off maybe like I was because it's called Eli Roth, he features very infrequently. He asks a couple questions. The voices they got, it's Tarantino, Rob Zombie, Jordan Peele, it's just people who are interesting to hear because we don't hear them talk about these films very often. And they're all really interesting takes. And Ryan's in there for a couple. But I thought this was like everyone should, and you know, there's not a single horror fan who should be missing this, because even if it's mostly repetitive in terms of what you know, there will be some people comments that make you rethink, especially Jordan Peele. I think he's one of the smarter people when he's like just kind of recontextualizing certain things, like for instance with Night of the Living Dead, the one thing he said that I just never really thought about is it's a big deal that there's a lead who's a black guy, right? That's a big deal. But what's real, and it wasn't actually him, it was a professor who's on there, an African-American professor. And she goes, no, the real crazy part is that he's telling them what to do. That's the part that's crazy. There's a middle-aged white man who runs a business being told, you go downstairs, by a black man on screen in 1968. That's unheard of. It's one thing having a lead, but the guy is like yelling, and it's like, and I had never thought about that angle. So I think it's fantastic. There's one on Creatures that's on my DVR. I haven't seen yet. And then I guess there's one more after that. But these could have been 3 hours and I would have watched every second. They're highly produced. AMC's put money into it.
But Fulci's never even mentioned?
Well, they showed him wrestling.
Why he's all forgiven?
Well, they showed him the wrestling of the shark scene, but you're like, they didn't even say the word Fulci. To me, you can't talk about Romero the whole time and not go, and the influence goes to people like Fulci, because it's just, he's the other name in that subgenre. Okay. So, yeah. And also, you don't spend 20 minutes on Walking Dead. Come on.
Maybe they're saving it for season two.
I don't know if there's going to be season two, but I know a lot of people who are probably like, yeah, it's going to be mainstream. It's actually really good. Like, it's definitely one of the more fun things that I've watched lately, where it's like kind of exciting to just see what they're gonna, also you don't know which ones they're gonna settle on, like Zombies Shaun of the Dead became a major part, which wouldn't be my pick, but I thought it was actually pretty interesting. So I think it's a 6-part thing from memory, from what I
remember. Or it might be 8, I don't know. I haven't delved into it yet. I'm gonna watch it on the AMC website,
and I bet they'll
AMC
come
anymore.
To Shudder, because it's AMC owned.
Oh yeah,
I don't,
that's right.
I don't know that, yeah. But I would be shocked if that doesn't
yeah that's that
there.
Sounds like a safe bet,
but it's showing what AMC is doing with horror.
They're
doing a lot
they're
of
really
good
trying.
Things
yeah. Let me talk music really quick, because obviously, as most listeners know, I'm a huge soundtrack fan. I've been buying a lot of vinyl. There's been a lot of vinyl coming out the last couple of months in general. Suspiria soundtrack by Tom York, which we mentioned before. Great buy. Definitely worth checking out. Here's one that I tweeted about, and people didn't know that was out on vinyl. Hellbound Hellraiser 2.
Ooh.
Christopher Young's score has just come out on vinyl through Lakeshore Records in like this cool little red marble record. And they had put out the original about maybe a year or two ago on vinyl again. Because here's the thing that you know, it's one of the most famous operatic, beautiful scores ever made. And of course, the history, if you know a lot about Hellraiser, you know, Clive wanted the Industrial Act Coil to do it. It got rejected.
Steven Thrower, you can hear all about the stories on that on the new supporting character podcast by that guy, Bill Ackerman. Steven Thrower's on it, and a big section of that, they actually talk about Coil and how that happened.
Wow.
I was like, oh, that's really cool.
And I've heard it. You could just search online, you'll find it. It's interesting. But really, I can't imagine Hellraiser without that Christopher Young score.
The romanticism of his music is huge.
Oh yeah, yeah. And for a long time it was kind of a very coveted record, because the original pressings were very hard to find and expensive. And so Lakeshore put out a version that has the poster art, which is what I always prefer. Mondo did one with the Through Death Waltz. So they did a big release for the first one. But a lot of people didn't realize that they just released Hellbound Hellraiser 2. And I actually think this is like even better a score. Because, you know, again, Christopher Young got hired to do the first one. This, he gets to do the theme and kind of elaborate on it and do a lot more. And so this is just available again. You could find it on – you could get the vinyl on Amazon if you really want to. I always recommend TwoHeadedDog.com, because they're like my Diabolik for records, and they always pretty much have everything in stock. I also have to mention also from Lakeshore, for Mandy, Panos. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Panos Cosmonis was on, and a lot of people that have seen the movie, it seems like I saw a lot of Halloween costumes for
they
Mandy.
They won trivia. We had a great team.
Team. That was wonderful.
They even had a dog dressed as a tiger, the tiger Lizzie. It was great.
I saw a lot of Cheddar Goblin costumes. But no, a lot of people have been talking about the music to this, which was Johan Johansson. And unfortunately, he passed, so this is his last score. And it's available digitally, and you can find it. But I jumped on the vinyl, and I talked about it a little bit when Panos was here. But this is one of those that sold out immediately. And so I'm here to tell you that because of the demand, they are reissuing it, and it'll be out again November 30th. Cool. And again, you could find it on Amazon. You could find it on Two-Headed Dog and basically anywhere else that you can find records, since that's kind of an in-demand one. And also, I love that when the word Mandy comes up in the movie, it looks like a freaking death metal logo. Yeah. That is what the cover of the record looks like, but it's black, so you could barely make it out. You just see the shape in there. So it's super cool.
Of any movie this year, that's one of the few movies that gives me a little bit of hope about cinema right now. Not so much the movie, but just the fact that that's like one of the few times where an indie film got a tiny release, went out of theaters, and then got demand to come back into theaters.
Yeah.
And that just doesn't happen anymore. And so that is just, I don't know, it just kind of warms your heart that some movies will still catch, and there's people realizing a big screen experience is actually
worth
important.
It. Yeah.
And you can't stress it enough with, especially a movie like that, where it's all about the aesthetics, you know?
Yeah, 100%. And so that's that. Oh, and just for our listeners, John Carpenter, the mighty John Carpenter, who we love.
The master of horror?
Toured, yes,
that's
the master
that
of
John
horror,
Carpenter?
The guy that's toured quite a bit. If you didn't get to see him And maybe, I don't know if this is a secret or not. I don't think it is. But you should go to stormkingproductions.com, which is obviously John Carpenter and his wife, Sandy King Carpenter, their production house. And you might be able to find a Blu-ray of their live show.
Ooh.
For $20, which I totally ordered, and it's wonderful. So yeah, there is a physical Blu-ray release of John Carpenter's tour with his kids, and it is, I mean, I think that's the only place you can get it is directly through them, but it is wonderful. I posted a link on our group, and people loved it, and so anyone that's listening that's not active on our group, John Carpenter live on Blu-ray.
And exciting tie-in. We will have John Carpenter as our guest on the day. And all right, and moving on.
When?
To the
What?
Clatu Verati necktie. Neckturn. Definitely an N-word. Anyway.
Well, one final plug before we go. For all of you who are in the Virginia, Maryland, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Washington, D.C.
state area.
You're
casting a wide driving.
No, because there's literally the area of Virginia where I'm from, you touch all those states. It's like West Virginia is 3 minutes from my parents' house, but then Maryland's like 10 miles, Pennsylvania's like 15, and then D.C.'s like 30. So it's
And you have your own draft house?
Yes, and we have our own draft house.
I wish there was a cool film playing there.
Hey, guys, this Saturday, which is the, I should know that, the 10th? This Saturday, the 10th. My film, All the Creatures Are Stirring, will be playing at the Winchester, Virginia Alamo Draft House.
I wish there was a cool guest.
I'm going to be there.
There is a cool guest.
Yeah. And so will my parents, which is the weirdest thing ever.
Get them to sign posters.
My mom knows what I do because she comes out here and visits and stays around. And sometimes she'll do craft services on my shoots and things like that. Plus, mom's always been a horror and sci-fi fan. My dad knows nothing about film. And if it doesn't have Clint Eastwood or the Duke in it, he doesn't watch it. And so as far as he knows, I'm an actress. And I've been trying to explain to him for years that I don't act. But he's just like, I don't know. She does something in film. I think she acts or something.
I'm hoping an old FBI agent is sitting there waiting for your mom going, I heard you've been bootlegging tapes. I've been listening to Killer POV from the very start. Becca
they
told us everything.
They still have every single one.
They're
literally, if you open up their living room closet, it is hundreds upon hundreds of bootleg tapes from the 80s. Thanks, Mom and Dad. Yeah. But but I'm sure I will watch them.
They didn't read that FBI warning. They're going to get snapped.
They don't have a DVD player yet, and they don't have like streaming services, so I'm going to watch Return of the Living Dead on dubbed VHS tape while I'm home. So there
you
go.
That's your prerogative.
I know. So anyway, if you are in the Virginia area, please come check out All the Creatures We're Stirring. The movie does not come out until December 4th to VODs, but we're doing a couple of screenings before that, the first one being this one in Virginia on November 10th.
All right. Yeah, and I also played in Knoxville, but it was right before I got there.
Yeah,
but
and you've seen it.
I saw it, I saw it in
Got screenings coming up in San Diego. We're doing Dallas. We're in Indiana for a stretch, so we're kind of all over the place. So I'll be plugging them as they come up.
And if you see it for no other reason, to see my five-year-old child.
And you're in it, too.
I'm not in it.
Yes, you are.
Oh, that's right. I'm an extra.
You're an extra. Totally you sit in the audience.
Yeah,
you're pretty
featured
in it.
I have
Elric.
Like very severe expressions through.
You do. And so does your child.
I totally forgot about that. He was laughing.
So. No, you're in it. You have a credit.
Well, there you go. There's your reason. And all of you who try to watch Tales from Halloween to try to see me and always fail because I'm only a shoulder. You
know? That's
so don't try. Yeah, I'm not really featured in that.
Oh, wow.
Somebody was trying to do the trifecta. They saw you and Rob, but nope, you're just wasting your time. You'll never see me.
Well, Elric's in this one, along with Mike Mendez and Axel Carolyn and Sean Keller and Chelsea and a whole bunch of other people that have been on the
Elric.
Show.
You're I know. Trying too hard
I'm trying too hard now.
Don't oversell your film.
That's just the sprinkles.
You just tell
Elric
them your extras
the
are good. All right. Okay, well, we'll be back with, you know, people who release some of the most bonkers and hard-to-find movies.
Petey Wheatstraw.
Mm-hmm. They've got one coming out that I am a huge fan of that has John Cassavetes against rapey demons, so you won't want to miss this.
This week's Shockwaves is brought to you by Wellgo USA. They have two amazing titles releasing the Steelbook this month. First is Phantasm Remastered. Phantasm Remastered is now available in a limited edition Steelbook Blu-ray with new bonus footage from director Don Coscarelli. Yes, Phantasm is now available in HD thanks to the meticulous restoration of J.J. Abrams and his Bad Robot team. Follow Mike, Jody, and Reggie as they embark on what is to be a long, nightmarish journey in the face of evil in lush 4K. Hurry before they're dead gone. also releasing from Welga USA, the record-breaking international smash hit Train to Busan is now available in a limited edition Steelbook Blu-ray with many new bonus features. Simple trip to Busan for his daughter's birthday turns into a fight for survival as Suk-woo and his daughter Su-an find themselves trapped on a suspicious, filled, blood-drenched bullet train to a safe zone, which may or may not still be there. Hurry before this zombie train has left the station.
Today's episode of Shockwaves is sponsored by Diabolik DVD, featuring demented discs from all over the world. Check them out online at www.diabolikdvd.com. They're the number one source for horror, cult, and strange films from around the world. The company is movie buff owned and operated. If you're looking for rare, unique, and strange films, then you need to head on over to Diabolik DVD. They're constantly updating their inventory and have plenty of movies that you won't find anywhere else. They recently revamped their website, and ordering has never been easier right now on Diabolik. They have the exclusive all-region Blu-ray of Death House, which has been called the Expendable of Horror, starring genre legends Adrian Barbeau, Barbara Crampton, Bill Moseley, Debbie Rochon, Dee Wallace, Felicia Rose, Gunnar Hansen, Kane Hodder, Michael Berryman, Sid Haig, and Tony Todd, all in one movie. They also have the all-region Blu-ray of Cheeborg. An alien fugitive crash lands on Earth and begins turning people into cyborgs that feed on animal flesh. Dylan and her best friend Eddie have to team up to stop the Cheeborg before the whole town is assimilated into monstrous machines of destruction. So, for all your horror and cult cinema needs, head on over to www.diabolikdvd.com. Or find them on Facebook. I know I'll be ordering extra from them very soon.
Alrighty, welcome back to the show. And this is very exciting. Long time in the making. Partly our fault because we didn't realize that two members of this team were already in Los Angeles.
We've literally been talking about having them on for about 3 years now. We've been like, yeah, someday they're going to be out in LA and we're going to get vinegar syndrome on.
Yes. And they're here. We have Joe Rubin with us and Jeff Gattell. Welcome.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, man. And I always, the reason I love these shows, and actually our listeners love these shows, is we've had the guys from Scream Factory, David Gregory from Severn Films.
Twilight Time,
Nick Redman, Don May. We as fans love what you guys are doing because you're basically preserving these films that we all grew up on or the gems that we always heard about but never could find. And the weird thing about the Blu-ray format, HD in general, is that these movies look better than they have any right.
Yes. Oh my God.
There's no logical reason.
Well, I think we have to tweak what you just said. You said the movies we grew up on. When it comes to you guys, it's the fuck is that
movie?
How have I never heard of that thing?
No, because like there's so many that I've seen through you guys, like Naked, Liquid Sky is a good example.
Yeah, right. Yeah. No, there are
that
some
one
big ones,
I'd seen when I was in high school, went, what the fuck is this? And then I owned the VHS for years going, well, what the fuck is this? But it doesn't look very good.
Yeah.
And then you guys made it look so damn good.
But there are just so many titles that I'd never heard of, and that's kind of always thrilling and always feels like you're like, it's a risk. It's like gambling. You're like, oh, what is this? Great box art. I'm going to take a gamble.
It's funny that you say that because a lot of times when people come up to the booth and stuff at Monster Palooza and everything, it's all blind buys, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the whole point of like when you see on the forums and everything else, you talk about blind buys and people are like, I try to stay away from it. But it seems like at least from my perspective of being around Joe and Vinegar Syndrome, it's the idea is that there's a brand awareness and that if Vinegar Syndrome puts it out, even if you've never heard of it, that alone makes it worth your time to check it out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's why I think they have, you know, that Vinegar Syndrome has like this monthly program where you can get all the movies every month, even if you've never seen them or anything, because you trust that process. Mm. And that to me was like a great idea when Joe first was telling me about it. Like, oh, every month you're just going to get the titles that come out every month. And people really love that. Like they do really, really well just having those titles shipped to you every month. And you can get them in film canisters. Do you guys – we still do that, right?
Yeah. The film can is something that we just basically started doing because we had too many cans.
Yeah. No, it's a cool idea. Very charming way to do it. What, before we go any further, what are your roles with the company just so we know exactly what you guys do?
I'm one of the four owners. My primary partner, Ryan, and myself kind of founded it in 2012. We had been doing scanning and restoration work and that sort of thing. And it basically wasn't going all that well. So we decided, or he actually decided to, or suggested that we should try some home video stuff since I'd been collecting film for years, knew all sorts of filmmakers and producers and so on, and had access to lots of stuff. So we took a gamble with our initial release, which was the Herschel Gordon Lewis triple feature, and it took off much better than any of us would have expected. Mm. And basically kind of we winged it from there.
Formed a company, yeah.
I help out Joe on the West Coast if it's, you know, doing audio commentary stuff or any sort of special feature stuff, work in the booth at Monsterpalooza or Comic-Con, you know, getting the word out, that kind of thing on that side of things. So
cool.
So when you approached the very first one doing the Herschel Gordon Lewis Blood Trilogy, like what did you encounter?
Not the Blood Trilogy.
Oh, you guys didn't do
sex
the
films.
Oh, the sex films. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Excellent. So like what did you encounter with that first one? Like how did you go about hunting down the prints and doing the remastering and everything?
Yeah, and were you thinking a label or were you like, well, let's just get one release out and see where it goes? Like I just equate it to like having a record label. It's like, let's put out the 1/7 inch and see what happens.
It was an experiment.
Yeah.
We decided to try it out just to see what the response would be, kind of hoping that it would be good enough to warrant at least doing one every so often. Mm-hmm. And then in pre-production on this one, we saw that the response was strong enough to the point that we realized that we kind of had to do a label. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, to answer your question about where the material came from, on those three particular films, it actually came from a lab acquisition that I had been put in touch with by a filmmaker friend of mine, Sean Costello. Mm-hmm. And it, like a lot of these sorts of finds, it came very unexpectedly. Like I was talking to Sean about where materials for his films might have been, and he mentioned the lab that he most often used, and I asked him, well, have you ever checked this lab to see if any of your films are there? And he says, no, but you know, I have the owner's contact information still. Maybe you want to give him a call. So I called the guy up, and he was basically like, I'll send you the list. So we worked out a deal, basically, and these three films in particular, which were Linda and Abilene, Ecstasies of Women, and Black Love, which is a film that Lewis tried to disown, even though previously he had not. Basically, when it was lost, he could sort of admit to making it. When it turned up, he wanted to pretend it never existed.
Have you guys seen Black Love?
No.
It's basically a narrator and then a lot of scenes of just kind of like two people having sex, and the narrator is just like, Black Love is gorgeous. Look, look. And it
Well, that undersells it to a certain extent.
I thought it was overselling
it. Is he the narrator?
No.
I hope it's
a very sort of bored-sounding guy.
White guy. Yeah.
And there's a number of sequences that are like about giggly children like discovering people fucking. And
weird. Weird.
And how it's okay, though.
There's a lengthy scene of various people on a rotating platform, naked, like the platform very slowly goes around and around in a circle.
What year was this?
71.
Okay, so rotating beds were like all the rage then.
Well, this is like a little tiny platform.
They're all dancing.
Like theater movie.
And then there's also a sequence where a guy isn't turned on by his wife until she puts curlers in.
Yeah. It makes sense in the context because the narrator helps explain it.
Uh-huh. Oh, okay.
See, this is what I love about Jeff, by the way, because I see him at the conventions. It's like the way that these guys sell these movies. I will pick something up and just kind of look at it and be like, you'll say exactly what he just says. Like, listen, you know what you're going to see when you buy that disc and bring it home is this, this, and this happens. And you're just like, holy shit, I need to see this, I think.
I've been accused of hucksterism. I'll say that.
That's how I ended up with, I think it was called The Blood Sisters. It's the one where they're literally naked for the entire second half of the movie. Is that the
Nightmare
right
Sisters?
Name?
Nightmare Sisters.
Yeah. Which I strongly recommend.
Yes, Dakota. Which was someone talked me into that at one, I think it was a Texas Frightmare.
It was me.
And no, it was whoever was working the Vinegar Syndrome. Because I bought Maniac Cop 2, I got
Psycho Cop 2.
And because I like Sweet Back's Badass Song, I picked that one up and somebody was like, oh, you need Petey Wheatstraw, and just loaded me up. But I remember the Nightmare Sisters because they were like, they're literally naked for the entire second half of the movie. And I was like, okay, I'm in.
That was my favorite buy just because it was at Monsterpalooza last year.
Yep.
And I was at your table looking for stuff and David Dakota walked by and he's like, Rob, you should buy that. And he pointed to Nightmare Sisters and walked away. And I was like, I looked at the bag and went, oh, it's one of David's movies.
Yeah.
Sure.
The thing about David is great is that he comes over at the beginning of every show and he's just like, if anyone buys one of my titles, call me immediately. I'll come over and sign it. Do you have my number? Email me, text me. And it's just like, dude, it's okay. We'll get a hold of you. Tell him where I'm at immediately or I'll walk over.
That's funny.
I love David.
And then he gives you a copy of The Talking Cat.
I don't think you need hucksterism because your covers do it. Like Psychic Killer, how do you not buy it? Like, you can't not buy Psychic
Killer. Psychic Killer is an easy sell because you're like, it says PG, but it's got nudity in it and enough violence to be an R-rated movie. That's how we try to sell it.
Which is like a weird pitch because we've done a couple of those where, it has way more sleaze factor than you'd get in a PG movie, but it's still by R-rated standards mild. But the fact that it's sleazy for a PG is like a bigger sell than it's tame for an R.
Yeah.
Right. Why I love – I'm sorry, but talking about selling it, I think something – and I think it's evolved since the beginning. I love the kind of the effort that goes into the slip covers because the covers are like out of control, like in terms of like what is this? Like I bought Shot at the last one. I haven't watched it yet because my buddy Scott's like, you have to wait for me to watch this Shot movie. But you look at the cover and you're just like, I need this.
70% of the sale for the slipcovers is the slipcover, right? Like it's especially on those smaller titles, like Shot is something that I've seen at conventions that's hard. It's hard to explain necessarily because it doesn't really necessarily fit with the other titles. But it's like people do pick it up because it is a slipcover. We have people that just walk up to the table and they grab all the slipcovers. Mm-hmm. And that's it. You know, they want the slipcovers and they're going to watch the movie. And that's a good way to kind of slip something in their like Shot that may not necessarily jump out at people right away.
Right.
And so
that works. Did you start kind of doing that? Because Norm, for me as a fan, I was like, I always want the poster art. That's, you know, like, oh, I wanted the poster. But that's kind of been a natural evolution. I mean, I guess it's kind of like, for lack of a better term, like the Mondo mentality where it's like, oh, it's got this cool alternate art or whatever. So, I mean, when did you guys start doing the slipcase and alternate art?
Shot actually is the original art.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow. That's,
okay, so, mind blown.
That's cool. That's really cool.
So just before we get into the slipcover thing, a bit on Shot because I'm personally like very pleased to have put that out. It's one of my favorite things we put out this year. It came to me from one of the most incredibly gifted, I don't know what the other another word to call it is, film researchers I've met in the world of internet social friends in Sweden. And he will periodically just like recommend a film to me and I'll recommend a film to him and so on. And one day he says, have you ever heard of this movie Shot? And I'm like, no. So he sends me a Dropbox folder that has a VHS rip of the film and dozens of articles and ads and all sorts of other stuff about its production. And it was a $15,000 student film made in 1972 by like early 20s University of Illinois college students who were in love with a, like new American cinema.
Fresh Connection.
Yeah. And like German expressionism and various other things. Like, the movie opens with like a reference, I think, to Fassbinder. But so it was just like one of these little mind blowing, like, I can't believe this thing exists and how good it is and how well made it is and how just fresh it feels, even though it's relying on so many cliched tropes. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that the producer is the guy who, I guess, produces the daytime Emmys and produces the Roger Ebert Film Festival. And
which is also in Champaign.
So. Well, he's still working in the industry.
Yeah. So that's awesome. And he also, I think, produced Zulu Dawn.
Oh, wow.
But the director never made anything else. And I contacted him. And he basically was like, sure, you want to put it out? The director has the negative in his closet.
Wow.
So
are they all that easy? Because when I picture this type of work, especially from talking to David Gregory about some of his European trips, I picture it as very Indiana Jones, where you're like in these like dusty caverns trying to hunt down the print for Disconnected and things like that. Like, are they all just usually somebody has it in a garage, or is it like a hustle to find?
It's really a case by case. Like, Liquid Sky took over a year. And it's because Slava, who is a wonderful guy, is not all that adept with technology and computers and things like that.
Now,
so there's like a lot of.
Did he own the sole rights to the movie?
Yeah, he owned it. He and his wife own it. And you know, they produced it. They did everything on it.
And then Yuri Naiman Cinematography came and did the thing. Yeah, I worked with him a little bit.
Yeah, he supervised the grade, which was one of the most hectic supervisions we've ever dealt with. He is a perfectionist, putting it mildly. But back on the slipcovers, I actually don't remember which the first one was. It was probably something in 2016 or late 15, maybe. Possibly The Undertaker.
Huh.
But,
which is a great one.
Yeah.
Great.
It's one of my favorites.
And I'm not personally a disc collector.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I've never been a disc collector. I
can attest to that.
Well, you buy film reels, so.
Yeah, exactly. Like, and I said in some interview, and I like this as like a little slogan, my physical media object of choice is film.
Right.
And so for me, like, it personally does nothing to like have a bunch of Blu-rays on my shelf. And
leave that to me.
But so I was like, as I often am, and I'll give credit to Ryan for a lot of these sorts of ideas because he tends to be more in line with the thinking of collectors and fans and so on. And I'm like a cynical snob.
Okay.
So
I'll say this about Joe, because I do want to talk about – I asked the same questions about finding prints and everything. Mm. I've known Joe since he was about 15. And I can tell you that ever since then, he is like a filmmaker whisperer. That these guys, these producers, filmmakers, all of these people in this industry respond to him in a way I've never seen. And they come up and they'll talk to me and they'll be like, is Joe here? Can I speak with Joe? There is just something enigmatic and charismatic about him at the same time that I've never seen in another person. I don't know. Joe mentioned earlier Sean Costello. I don't know if you guys know who that is.
Yeah.
He's a porno filmmaker who made Water Power, which is the enema rape porn. I had never heard of this thing.
Let me clarify.
That's the first time enema rape porn has ever been said on this show.
We've done 200 episodes.
So, I think vomit porn has come up, but never this.
So Joe introduced me to this movie when I met him. So he was 15, and he's like, you have to see this. And I saw it, and then like a couple of days later, we're walking to lunch, and he goes, do you want to talk to the director of Water Power on the phone? And I was like, why do you have the phone number for this guy?
You guys have to be really good friends to be like, do you want to see an enema rape porn?
Yeah. Well, wasn't it your date movie with your wife-to-be?
The very first time I met my wife, we were at lunch. And she was like, so, like, tell me about this. Like, because Joe and I met working at a video store together called Odd Obsession in Chicago.
I worked at Facets, and I used to always go around the corner at Odd Obsession.
Yeah, we've discovered that we all worked at video stores.
So,
that's what happened.
Yeah. She was asking me, she goes, well, what, you know, like, what's so weird about Odd Obsession? And I said, have you ever heard of a movie called Water Power? And she's like, no. She's like, what is it? I said, it's an enema rape porn. And she's like, I'd be interested in that. And I'm like, interesting.
She's a keeper.
Yeah. 13 years later, we're still together.
You guys had a lot of cats at Odd Obsession. That's one thing that
Halstead location?
Yeah.
And birds. We had birds.
This was before the Ghana
this
posters.
This was the video store?
Yeah. Yes.
Facets had a huge collection, but whenever I would, like, they were a little further, but whenever I'd go down to Obsession, I would always be way more inspired and excited because it was much more like Cinephile or that kind of place, you know?
So you were going there when Precious, Tear, and Bailey were all there?
All those cats.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's impressive.
It was like a 2-year period a while back,
2014 to 16 or 15 or so?
I came out here in 2010, so it's before that.
Oh, sorry.
So it's like 2009.
Yeah, I got my dates.
2008 and
2004 to 2005.
Yeah, as
we left.
Those are the heyday. Yeah.
Oh, so it must be the other location then.
It was Milwaukee.
Yeah, Milwaukee's the one. Yeah. No, and I was always jealous because you guys had all the cool design.
Our place
was very generic, but it had an amazing collection. Your place was like, oh, there's posters everywhere, and it's the first time I heard of one of my favorite films, Arrabato, was there because it said Spanish, no subtitles, and I was like, I can't rent this, and I had to wait like 5 years from seeing it there to finally getting a German burger. DVD. So.
Do you remember the Porn Kid Recommends section?
I mean, I don't remember it, but
I
believe you that it was there.
That's what we called a sticker we created to put
on movies. So in Odd Obsession, I do like telling this little anecdote. Yeah. We had a little closet area at the back of the Halstead location, which would have ostensibly been the porn room, but instead we created the Blockbuster Ghetto, where all contemporary studio movies and TV shows went.
True.
Wow.
There was a sticker on the back of the Garden State DVD that said, if you're looking at this, get the fuck out of the store. I don't know who put it on.
I love video store culture. It's the greatest. It's the only white place you could get away with shit like that.
It's like record stores, too.
I have a question about, because this is something I feel like I heard about through AGFA or something weird, was that sometimes, like, something that was happening a lot in the last, like, 10 years were these places that actually stored the film would close down and they'd have unpaid for clients or people who never collected their films. Is that one of the ways you guys were discovering prints? Or
occasionally.
Uh-huh.
That's a real thing. I always thought it was like urban legend of the horror community.
No, there's periodic foreclosures. They haven't all – I mean, foreclosures at this point rarely yield anything all that exciting or useful. But in the past, they used to be an interesting way to find
– How does that work with rights though? Because like, yes, the film print's there and now you can grab the film print. But how could you possibly have the rights? Or is it just because
No one renew the rights for the past 50 years?
It's very much a case-by-case basis. Yeah. With exploitation films and a lot of horror stuff, the problem is either – you have the materials but not the rights, or you have the rights but not the materials. Finding movies where the rights owner has the materials is less common than you'd think.
Yeah, one of the titles I most wanted to see, and I always thought it would come out through you guys, and it might still, but I was hassle Ant Timpson about a lot because I saw it at his festival in New Zealand way back when I was like 20. As Candy Snatchers, and that film's, and that he started
it's
looking it up.
Released on DVD,
it did at one point.
Yeah, yeah.
But he said he looked down the rights, and he's like, "It is a mess."
It is a mess. And cut this.
Okay,
we're not doing it. But okay. But yeah, it's a very long mess that we have been involved with and trying to figure something out.
Hold on to that DVD because it is worth a lot of money.
I have a bad dub of it and it's shit.
No, I have the DVD release.
The Subversive Cinema.
It's such a fascinating film.
I
do too.
I saw it on film and loved it. I was like, oh, this is great. I liked it more than The Last House on the Left. I was like,
it's more stylish. Yeah. But I can see why it was so controversial because it is comedic and then there's rape. And then it's comedic again. And it's definitely. But I mean, The Last House on the Left has that as
it
well.
Say this about film prints too, in that some of the work that we do with ProTek Vaults, they have a specific idea where if somebody does not pay their fees for their storage of their film, ProTek refuses to throw anything away. And so they try to find other places for it within the vault, which in the offices, just because they're so connected. They're like, we never want to throw a film away. So they try to store it somewhere else, because sometimes filmmakers or someone will make a film and they'll be like, you know what? Like, I'm not going to pay my bill anymore. Just throw it out. And they just – it just goes in a corner somewhere just because of that love for it. And so it's waiting for somebody to find it.
I remember one search I did, because I love the Psychotronic Film Guide, obviously, growing up. But one day I went on eBay and – I guess Ant might have pointed this out too. The guy who made the Psychotronic Man, which is where the title came from for the magazine, he was selling the rights and his only print on eBay, and it was like
I remember that,
and it wasn't very expensive. And I was like, what? Like, you have a feature film and you're selling? I think it was like, I don't know, a couple grand for his movie, and I saw it on TCM.
That's actually about right, Joe.
I mean, it's crazy.
In terms of cost of stuff, sometimes.
Sometimes, you know, there's a huge range.
Yeah.
But another instance of an eBay sale, the owner or the estate of the owner of Patty, the Patty Hearst sex film, was sold on eBay. That's how Synapse got it.
Oh, wow.
For like $4,000. And I remember this. I was considering buying it myself. Yeah. This is back in like 2006 or something. And I didn't. But,
yeah. And you're still kicking yourself. Well, I mean, in terms of economics, can that make $4,000 back, that particular title, just like roughly?
Yeah, in time.
Yeah.
Well, how does it work with the porns? Like, because that's a whole different area. How do you guys find, like, what porns do you think will release and which ones are unreleased?
That's all Joe. He has been an expert in this. This is why we called him Porn Kid at 15, is that his knowledge of pornography is worldwide. Like, I would say you could not maybe find more than 10 people who knew more about pornography than Joe.
So when I lived in New York City for like a decade, I used to go to 42nd Street Pete's screenings all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with 42nd Street Pete? Okay. So he would like find these old reels, and I was always intrigued about how that worked and if it's different from horror, like where you go to hunt down the porn reels and things like that.
Again, it's very much case to case. The vast majority of the films that we've released that are hardcore, we own the rights to ourselves. Very few are licensed. And these movies in particular are or have been easier to just buy outright as opposed to license, because the majority of people who made them, who are still around, see absolutely no future with them themselves. So they're happy to take whatever they can get to just like get rid of the stuff. But I don't know. We own the rights to like some very random, unexpected ones of crossover appeal, like Nine Lives of Wet Pussy, which is Abel Ferrara's.
It's a great movie. If you haven't seen it, it's top 10 Ferrara.
Wow.
And he's in it. So if you want to see Abel Ferrara's dick, buy the movie. There's some hucksterism for you.
Yeah. No, I actually really do.
Now, are there porn titles that you guys have sought out? Like, there's this one that I saw that was shot in scope that I've always been like, why did no one ever? Panorama Blue.
That is a rights mystery.
Okay, because that's when I'm always like, it was actually a beautiful porn. And I was always like, and I saw it and I was like, this is shot in scope. And it was a bootleg that I saw.
Yeah, it was a sexploitation tribute to This Is Cinerama.
Mm-hmm. And I've always been curious why that hasn't had a nicer release, because it was fascinating to watch. So
there are some other ones that were shot in scope. They're all 3D, though.
Oh, wow. 3D scope porn. That is crazy.
They used to show them in Chicago when Joe
Disco
and I lived there.
Disco Dolls and Hot Skin and Lollipop Girls and Hard Candy.
Did we see Lollipop Girls at the Music Box?
Both of them.
I remember, because I was sitting next to you in the in 3D watching it with you, and there's nothing like getting a dick in your face in 3D.
But the other one that we might release, we will release at some point, is the Fireworks Woman or Man, which is the hardcore feature that Wes Craven directed.
Yeah, we actually, when we had Blumhouse.com up and running, we had one of our writers do a big article on it, which I've heard if you watch it, suddenly the phone scene from Nightmare on Elm Street makes more sense.
Hadn't thought about that. So the things that I really love about that film is it features another version of And Now You're All Alone, which is a superior version, I think.
Yeah.
It has like a nice sort of dreamy sense of lyricism to the editing. And Craven, Sean Cunningham, and Wes Craven's son are all in it.
In the film?
Yes.
Wow.
That's how you keep a family together. Yeah. You just share the porn. How'd you get disconnected? Because we showed that at Jump Cut. Mike Williamson had a 16mm print. He showed
God,
it
years ago.
Years ago, but yeah. I remember the main story being that the guy had turned into like making religious films or something.
No, not at all.
Really? But he had no interest
in
that.
That was the rumor back when we screened it. It's like, because he was, you know, Mike would show us films and be like, you're never going to see this ever. And it was like, I thought he like said he called him or something like that. I can't remember what it was.
I had no interest in this film ever getting seen.
He didn't want anybody to ever see it.
Yeah,
and I remember it had a song in it that we were questioning if he'd actually licensed it, because it was like a well-known, like R.E.M. or something. It was like a well-known song.
No, he makes music documentaries. Like he's very heavily involved in the music documentary world.
Oh, well, that's very different than religious films.
No, he's been pretty easygoing.
So you're saying Mike Williamson is full of shit? And we can put that on record.
And it's still on air?
I think that he was just confused, perhaps, or misinterpreting.
This is also an example of Joe being that whisperer, right? Where he just is able to talk to these people.
I actually get no credit for that. That was 100% Brandon.
Oh, wow. Good for Brandon to do that, then.
Well, it was. So Brandon is one of our oldest employees.
And one of the nicest.
I hate using the word employee because, like, Brandon and James and Chris, who are the main people who really do like 75% of everything.
They do the conventions, right? Brandon's the one I think I've met the most.
Brandon's the one that we talk to a lot.
I've talked to the most.
But they do everything.
Like Brandon is the scanner operator almost 90% of the time. James and Chris do all of the shipping stuff and all of our coordination, like a lot of the social media and so on. So, but Brandon is a born and bred Connecticutite or whatever, however that should be said. And for whatever reason, he likes Connecticut. And, and as such, perhaps has more of an affinity for Connecticut filmmakers. And Gorman, who directed Disconnected and Psychos in Love, is Connecticut based. Uh-huh. And basically we approached him on Psychos in Love and he was into that. And then we're like, well, can we get Disconnected as well? And he's like, no. So there was truth to the fact that he wasn't like excited to have it out. And I think to a certain extent it was because it was his first film. So he can like look back and I think like, you know, I would have done this differently, or, you know, not proud of some decision or whatever it is. But we eventually convinced him, and he sort of reluctantly agreed. And back on materials, that was scanned from his personal print. And we found the negative, like, long before the release was supposed to come out, and the lab denied they had it, even though we had proof that they had it. And this particular lab is sort of notorious for doing that.
What benefits them from doing that?
Nothing benefit. They don't benefit at all. They just get to be lazy.
That's a shame.
But this is also might have been an instance where they destroyed it and didn't want to admit it. Not like intentionally destroyed it, but this is a prominent New York lab that had their film vault on the very top floor of the building. And had a leaky roof. So instead of repairing the roof, they put tarps under the ceiling. So you like walk through the vault and there would be like translucent tarps full of water.
I don't know if you guys have ever been in film vaults that are not refrigerated or anything, and are sometimes not taken care of. And we have several here in LA, but they're just – they're not taking – they're the people that work there are not archivists. They're not film fans. It's an hourly wage job. You're just sitting there all day and they just – they just let it go. And, you know, from Vinegar, from Protac, from the ones that are really filled with people that are very interested and care about all of this stuff, these are people that are like, man, we never want to work for a company like that. You know, we never want to be around that. And I won't besmirch anybody. I won't say anything bad about the companies that do it. But there are some high-profile, large organizations who deal in archiving a variety of materials that aren't film. And so to archive film and have to do it differently costs them more money. And so they see that as a disadvantage.
Oh, man. Here's a question, because I guess getting into this, you know, the first thing you didn't know would turn into a label turns into a label. Then what are a couple of the dream titles that you would always just like dreamed of getting your hands on that you actually achieved? What were some of the ones where it was like a big deal? Because I'd have to guess Rudy Ray Moore or something like that would have been someone's passion project.
Actually, no. That just sort of came to us randomly.
I remember Christmas Evil being a kind of a big – that was the one that kind of really turned me on to your label.
That still sells really well, too. Right?
Yeah, that's
favorite
a
Christmas movie of all time.
Popular.
I love that film so much.
You dressed as it for Christmas a couple of years ago, right?
Kind of. I was one of them. Oh. I could have been any of them.
So as I will often sort of jokingly but depressingly say, the titles that I'm most fond of tend to be the worst sellers.
Yeah.
So no, we're going to move units tonight. Tell us what they are.
Tell us. Give us three titles.
Good Luck, Miss Wyckoff.
One of my favorites, too.
Haven't seen that one yet.
Is this more of like a horror or a porn or a
soft horror? It's like a drama. It's a really great movie.
So I'll give you the cast. Yeah. It stars Anne Haywood, Donald Pleasance, Robert Vaughn, Dorothy Malone, Ronnie Blakely, Earl Holliman, some other people that I'm probably
written by Polly Platt after Bogdanovich divorced her.
Oh, wow.
Directed by Marvin Chomsky, fresh off of Roots. Shot by Alex Phillips Jr., who shot Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia.
Wow. Okay.
Music by Ernest Gold, who won the Oscar for Exodus.
So why is it an unknown, largely unknown film?
How because it's here's actually since we I have to bring him up.
Yeah.
A Banana Man story.
Oh.
So
for those not in the know, we are talking about Code Red's Bill.
I've been referring to him on the internet as just BM. I think it's an easier acronym.
Yeah.
It has a double entendre to it.
But it's true.
He did dress up as a Banana Man for me and Brian on the other show. So yes. I will say he did.
So I first heard about Good Luck, Miss Wyckoff on a thread on a now basically defunct forum called DVD Maniacs, which turned into AV Maniacs. Sure. And it was in a thread called like, what's the most disturbing movie, or like, what's the most mean-spirited movie you've ever seen? And someone suggested that film, so I'd never heard of it. And I looked it up and I was like, oh, this sounds interesting, but I don't know how it could be the most mean-spirited movie ever made. And I couldn't find a copy of it. We didn't have it at Odd Obsessions, so as I often do, I just downloaded it off of Cinemageddon and was just blown away. It's a consistently nasty, very socially conscious period piece drama set in rural Kansas in the mid-50s about this kind of liberal-ish, you know, as in she supports racial integration, high school teacher who is also a virginal spinster. So she is having all these like weird health problems, and she goes to a doctor, and the doctor is basically like, you're a virgin, so your body is entering early menopause. You better find someone to fuck soon.
I will say this. This is an exploitation version basically of Raquel. Huh, Rachel. I'm sorry. Rachel, the Paul Newman film.
Based on a William Inge novel.
Yes.
One of the two novels he wrote.
Huh.
And so she...
Is this for sale right now?
Yeah.
On your side?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Good luck. This will be the first one I'm buying now.
Basically, eventually she has a very unexpected first sexual encounter, which changes her outlook on things, but not in necessarily good ways.
It's a very violent encounter.
Okay.
But another friend of mine from the Auto Session days, I recommended the film to him, and he found the rights and was like, here, I'll put you in touch with the rights owner, and we worked out a deal. So the day that I announced it, I get a call from Bill, and he's screaming, how do you have the rights to Good Luck, Miss Wyckoff? And you know, his usual rants, and I tell him who we got the rights from. He's like, he doesn't own it, blah, 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 as he often will say. So I'm like, you know, that's not really my problem. You know, I've got a license agreement with him. If you have an issue with that, you take it up with him. And he, you know, was like, you're going to get sued or whatever.
You'll pay.
Yeah. So the next day he calls me up. And so the film was funded by this, like, I think he's dead now, but 90 or so year old pharmaceuticals guy out of Indiana. And he and his other partner were the owners, and I got off of one of them. And they, you know, they were working together. So Bill calls me the next day, and he's like, I talked to the 90-year-old guy, and you're right. You have the rights. But he's old. He's going to die soon. He should die. And the other guy, I hope he has a slow and painful death.
Wow.
That's a classic.
He calls you just to threaten other people. That's fun.
I think you should put that on the box. The code red Bill says, I hope the producer of this dies. Yeah, sell some units. Okay, that one sounds like a very interesting movie.
So good luck, Mrs. Wyckoff.
Good luck, Miss Wyckoff.
Miss Wyckoff.
Because she's a virginal spinster, so she's not married.
Got it.
So, all right, another two. Runaway Nightmare.
Yeah.
That movie.
I own that one and haven't watched it yet.
So what's Runaway Nightmare?
Runaway Nightmare is about these two guys who are worm farmers in Death Valley.
That's a thing?
Yeah, in this film.
He doesn't know in reality.
They're sunning themselves on rocks and bickering, and they see a truck pull up and there's two guys in the truck bring out a coffin and they bury it in the desert.
Oh, that's the one where the cover looks like Kiss Me Deadly Ending. That cover has the look of that. So it's got the person opening the light box.
Oh, that does look like Kiss Me Deadly.
It looks just like the ending of Kiss Me Deadly.
Oh. That's actually just a shot from the film.
Oh, okay.
But part of the ending. And the director, producer, writer, star, editor of it is very filmically informed. And during the commentary pointed out some very unexpected references, including an editorial nod to Jaws. So the two guys, after the coffin is buried, like they go and dig it up, and they discover a woman inside, and they take her back to their like house, and then they're kidnapped by these pseudo, not feminist, but like female militant man haters, where they're taken back to their lair and turned into slaves and forced to help them.
Easy sell.
Achieve their goal of stealing a suitcase full of
plutonium.
Platinum.
I'm reading it.
Platinum.
Oh, it says plutonium on IMDb.
That's incorrect.
It also calls them nerdy dork worm wranglers.
Is that how you would describe them, John?
I guess. So the guy who made the film, and this was like his – it took 3 years to make. He was a start and stop production. His dad owned the carnival where the carnival scene from Strangers on a Train was shot.
Oh, cool. Ooh.
And yeah, his house is amazing. It's like a shrine to 40s, 50s, 60s carnival signage and stuff.
Oh,
so it's a nightmare?
Yeah.
Well. Yeah. So another film we've actually recently put out, Pets. Mike Cartel, who made Runaway Nightmare, is interviewed on it because he plays Candace Rowlison's brother, who is beat up at the beginning of the film as he's chasing her. And But yeah, so Runaway Nightmare was a very similar situation. I just like read about it and thought this movie sounds fascinating. I couldn't find it. I downloaded it and wrote a Facebook post about it, of all things. And then a guy I know on Facebook emails me like 2 years later and is like, hey, I found the director. You wanted me to put you in touch?
So it's a different world when you can do pull off that. But I'm excited because I actually bought this one because of Brandon, I think, and yeah. I have never watched it somehow. So
it it ends with a, I'm guessing, a tribute to Animal House with like a Where Are They Now text intertitles.
With the feminazis?
Yeah. Every single one gets like a postscript biography.
Oh, nice.
Then an epilogue, which is completely inane and ridiculous and just makes the film for me.
And what's the third one?
Third one.
Telephone book?
Telephone book has sold well. I'm trying to think of ones that have not sold
etiquette
well.
Stuff? Push the etiquette titles.
Okay, sure. Some Call It Loving. Okay.
One of my favorites, though. Uh-huh.
So the second feature film directed by James Harris, who was Stanley Kubrick's producing partner for years. That's right. And it's this beautiful, sort of surreal, dreamy, loose adaptation of Sleeping Beauty starring, Zalman King, Tiza Farrow.
Blue Sunshine, Zalman King.
A pre-zombie Tiza Farrow and
Richard Pryor.
And a pre blue collar Richard Pryor.
Wow, I'm looking at footage of this and it looks like a Franco film. Far from it, I'm guessing.
Oh, it's got
sort of
nuns.
Kind of. Oh, yeah, it looks very.
What genre is this?
It's kind of like a psychological auto, like kind of a psychological erotic drama with very little eroticism.
Hold on, but Richard Pryor's in it?
Yes.
Okay.
As a junkie.
Okay. That's good. Yeah.
I'm just looking through this like crazy film, and then images of him pop up.
And it's one of the most gorgeously photographed films we've released. It was shot by Mario Tosi, who shot Carrie.
Uh huh. Wow. How do you guys get some of the bigger ones? Because like I get used to like those kind of titles, and then suddenly like I might be wrong in terms of big, but like to me, The Hearse feels like a big title that people are. It feels like it's like
Crown International package deal.
Okay, yeah. So you just got to inherit it with other titles. Because I thought that was a great release. And I actually really liked the film. That surprised me.
I do, too. Like, one of my
like Burnt projects. Offerings, it should go with that film, those two together.
I'm not fond of Burnt Offerings.
Oh, really? I love Burnt Offerings.
No, the Hearse is a film that inspired me in one of my unproduced scripts.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, like, no, it's something. I mean, it feels like a kind of lost classical horror film. It doesn't feel like, you know, a modern horror film. And I think
it feels about 20 years older than it is.
Yeah, it's George C. Scott's wife, right? As the
Trish Van Devere.
Yeah, no, but that's what. But there's a couple. You have a few handful of titles like that. And I'm always, I guess, I'm surprised because so many of them are like the Blood Beats, where you're like, that was one
wonderful.
I got that one a few years ago from one of the, I think, a Monster Palooza like 5-6 years ago on a really shitty DVD, and then I passed it around to everyone I could because I was like, it's a Christmas horror film with Samurai Ghosts, like what in Wisconsin. And
yeah, and then you guys put it out on Blu-ray.
I still haven't seen
the Blu-ray. People love buying that. That Slipover sold out, but people would pick that up and like, I have to have this. I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
But no, I need to have it.
I mean, it's pretty. Yeah, I just don't know how a movie like that exists, honestly. That's one of those ones where you're like, how did that get made? Yes. I love the food sequence where food's just flying out of our fridge. I'm like, that's actually pretty well made.
And it's almost Christmas time, so it's time to celebrate the one and only
Blood Beats.
Yeah.
I'll say this. Sometimes you challenge yourself when you're at conventions and you're selling. You're like, if I can get one Catch My Soul and one, you know, Some Call It Loving, and then maybe I can get somebody to buy a Hobgoblins. Yeah. If I can get all these three together, I can get this one guy to get all three of these. I can really blow his mind.
Yeah.
And so you challenge yourself that you see him kind of looking around and picking stuff up, and you're like, let me help you out, sir. Do you like, you know, musical Othello set on a commune directed by Patrick McGoohan? And how about Small Puppets? What if I put those together for you?
Yeah.
And then he's like, oh, I'm intrigued. Like, tell me more, salesman.
Wait, Hobgoblins is a musical?
No, but Catch My Soul is.
Okay.
So if you can get
you
Catch
just
My
sold
Soul.
One Catch My Soul.
Joe White.
Yep. Catch My Soul is great.
That's kind of my jam, is weird offbeat musicals that shouldn't actually exist. Go Howling 5.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah.
Here's a point of trivia on Catch My Soul. The reason it exists is because Tales from the Crypt made a lot of money.
Yeah.
So it was like a spinoff of that or something?
No,
it was
the people who ran Metro Media made a lot of money off of Tales from the Crypt. So the producer of Tales from the Crypt was basically given the ability to do what he wanted. So he did this. And it made zero money.
It didn't come out, I don't think, right, Joe?
No, it briefly came out.
Briefly. One theater.
The producer noted that when he went to see it in New York, there were a couple of nuns in the audience, and that was it.
But I mean, I guess with these bigger titles, I guess I don't, this is in my brain there, but like Incubus being the one I teased before you guys came on is a film that I've been talking, I feel like I've been talking about this one for years, a film I just always was affected by because it's kind of a slasher thing and then it's a demon rape movie and it's John Cassavetes and you're like, what the hell? But also think it's a pretty good film, effective horror film, and I haven't seen the new release of it, so I'm excited about that one. But how to, that strikes me again as a bigger title, you know, with actual stars and it's not just totally indie financed, I assumed. How do these ones come into your deals?
It actually was entirely independently financed.
That one was?
Yeah, we've ironically, our only studio title is Catch My Soul, which came from Fox.
Huh.
And that was just, you know, a matter of the producer literally calling up the owner of Fox and saying, you're not doing anything with it, give it to them. So,
wow.
But no, like stuff like The Incubus and I guess Cutting Class is relatively speaking a bigger title.
Yeah.
Those often just come by accident. Like we'll get access to like someone's availabilities list or I'll just meet someone or see something somewhere implying that it's available. And, I don't really necessarily go out seeking specific things. Like a lot of titles either find me or I just sort of cross paths with them. Or in other cases, I find material and based on material, I'm like, okay, I found the negative for this, so I should try to figure out who owns it.
What about the war? I don't know if it's a literal war, but between all these companies, now we're at a point, we always ask Screen Factory about this because they're getting things and then other people are getting things that would be suitable. Obviously, you guys are a little more outside the box than most of the, if I'm thinking, especially between Screen Factory and, say, Synapse. A lot of these titles seem to kind of interweave.
Well, you know what? I always equate everything to music. I look at it as just like a different record labels and they have their thing that they do. To me, it was beautiful seeing the last Texas Frightmare that we were at. And I mean, that show keeps getting bigger and bigger every year. And I remember, I guess Friday, there's like, you know, people are literally lined up to get into the convention. And as soon as they like opened the doors, it was you guys, Arrow, and Severn Films, like all next to each other. And just, it looked like Black Friday. Like there was just people that ran to those three tables and are just like, you know, going nuts for these Blu-ray releases. And so, yeah, I mean, what is your relationship like with some of the other labels? Because again, I think, at least from what I could see, there seems to be synchronicity in the types of films you guys
are. I mean, like we talked about, it's brand awareness, I think. And Vinegar Syndrome, I think you looked at most of the titles. They're mostly U.S. based. Some regional filmmaking, some, you know, other Severin, you know, sometimes it's UK stuff. It's like different, it's other countries, Italian stuff. Synapse, you know, is like a little bit American, a little bit, you know, different countries. But in my perspective, I think when you look, I think you can tell from the titles and the look of what a Vinegar Syndrome movie is, and it's separate from what other companies are. And I think I personally feel like all those, you know, David Gregory and Severin, I mean, he's a really great guy. All those guys do great stuff. I buy their titles too.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's what's important is that they're across organizations and across these companies, everyone is in this for the same reasons for the most part, which is to put out stuff and and our fans too. You know, whether you buy Blu-rays or not, like Joe is still a fan, you know, and he still knows all this stuff. And so putting all these people together, they all enjoy each other's company for the most part, which is a big positive.
And the fans buy everything. Like I would never just buy Arrow or I'm only buying Synapse. Like I buy everything that comes out.
And I'll say this, like everyone is really appreciative too. It's not this is a business where it's about giving people what they want and they're very happy to get it. You know, it's not a goal of like selling them something that they really don't need.
Mm-hmm.
It's a matter of like, hey, you want to buy these titles. And I think sometimes it depends on where you go, but Monsterpalooza for me here, you know, at Pasadena and Burbank is a great example of people coming to a smaller festival. It's not Texas Frightmare, just to basically be like, hey, I want to buy this. You know, that's why I come here. It's not a lot of, I mean, obviously there's autographs and stuff too, but there's not like a big show involved in it. And you see it where people just kind of line up like, man, I just really want to come and talk to you guys and buy this because they could buy them online from us, but probably in some cases cheaper on the Black Friday sales, whatever. But they come because they want to hang out. It's a communal experience. And without video stores and without, you know, some of the repertory stuff in LA right now with New Bev being closed, that's kind of closed a little bit for some people. And they want to be able to talk about it and buy it. So they don't just want to like give you the money and get the disc. They want to have a conversation about the movies and really get excited about it so they can go home and have some excitement in watching it. And I appreciate that.
That's what we hear. I mean, we hear that a lot about this podcast, that's why people listen to the part where we're just talking about what we watched, because it feels like they're in those conversations.
Yep.
Those video store type conversations we all used to have.
There's also, though, a certain level, at least from my perspective, and I've talked to other label owners, managers, et cetera, about this. We're all curators. So, yeah, there's a matter of, yeah, we're going to put out movies that people want, but we're also telling people what they should want by saying this movie is designated for a release by whatever label it is. That's saying that label is endorsing that film, which for me has been sometimes a bit of a hard pill to swallow.
My chauffeur!
Well, that's like in the bottom third, but there's a bunch of films, not many, but I'd say like at least a dozen probably that we've put out over the six years that we've existed, that I cringe when I look at and I'm like, why did we do this? Like, why did I listen to whoever suggested?
It's someone's favorite film.
Well, that's a Lustig quote that I've tried to subscribe to, and I was talking to him once in like 2014 or 15, and he was so that his ideology was he wants every single film he releases to be a film that is someone's favorite movie. Yeah. That like, yeah, that's what makes him feel good about what he's doing. And I think that's true, and it's weird listening sometimes to someone say how much they love a film that I personally hate.
Yeah.
And always disappointing when I'm really enthusiastic about something and then it's like, oh, you like that piece of shit?
I feel like you're talking about me.
I get that a lot on this show.
Taste is weird. I mean, you're wrong about Burnt Offerings.
That was only 5 minutes ago. So I
like Dan Curtis overall.
And
My favorite Dan Curtis movie is actually probably Curse of the Black Widow.
I haven't seen that one.
It's a really good one. I haven't seen that in a long time. I need to watch.
Interesting.
It's fun.
Can you let's talk a little bit? I mean, obviously, this is a big horror show. We've recommended a lot of your titles. I think there's nothing more excited because it is a gamble. There's a 50-50 shot.
They've had a lot of flack over Bloodhook. They've had some people write in saying that was the coolest thing ever, and other people wanting to threaten you.
We've talked a lot about Bloodhook.
Bloodhook got a lot of
controversial.
It
was a big discussion.
So much so that people went for Bloodhook on Amazon Prime, and it's like the shorter version. I'm like, no, you need to watch the full 2 hour cut.
You need the 2 hour on the cut Blu-ray.
That's a movie that sold on slipcover.
Yeah.
You want to talk about movies that sell on slipcover? Yep. Bloodhook, people were like, I got to have this. Look at the cover.
That was actually an amazing month because we put out Bloodhook, Norman Warren's Terror, and then a film called Blue Vengeance, which no one's heard of.
I loved that one. That was fun.
And all three of them, the slipcovers sold out during the pre-order.
Oh, wow.
Which has never happened before.
That's great.
That's pretty cool. Well, I was going to say, so what are like, I don't know, I don't want to say top five, but five horror recommendations.
I mean, for me, the ones that I always start with when people ask me is don't answer the phone.
Mm-hmm.
And The Undertaker. I start right off the bat with like, if you like sweaty fat guys strangling women,
Slaughterhouse isn't in there with that.
Slaughterhouse, you can talk. That's an additional one too. But
I'm wearing a fat guy who likes to kill women.
I always start with it. I'm like, do you like sweaty fat guys? Yeah, kind of. What if they're strangling women? Oh, yeah. So then I put them together. And the Joe Spinell pitch
is – You were meant to do this.
Yes.
The Joe Spinell pitch is easy. It's like he's never been sweatier. He's never been grosser. This is what you need if you love Joe Spinell.
Oh, yeah. For a second there, I wasn't putting together with that title. Yeah, him in the white suit. Yeah, it's a stranger. That's a stranger.
Oh. Yeah.
He's great at it. Yeah. And you can see it. Like, you get that collar gets real dark like that and everything just because he's just pouring off the back of him.
It's a weird world when you can use that as a selling tool. I mean,
it's only this industry.
Yeah.
This is it. You can't really use it anywhere else.
Actually, I guess a lot of horror movies are about sweaty fat guys.
It's a shockingly large subgenre.
It's just a reflection of its creators. It's not that surprising, really.
I think I actually really like Terror. It's a strange movie, but it's like I remember it being described to me I think by Brandon is basically like, do you like Suspiria? Well, the director likes Suspiria and he was English, so he made an English Suspiria. And it's like, that's a great pitch.
That's true. He basically said like he watched Suspiria and was like, I want to make one of those.
Have you guys seen this one?
I haven't seen this one. I got to put it on my list.
Okay,
I own it. I haven't gotten to it yet.
Yeah.
There's still a stack that I'm working through.
I'm ordering a bunch tonight, guys.
Instead of a dance studio, it's a sexploitation film production company.
Oh. Yeah. I'm kind of into that, you know? Okay.
And it's still all the colors in it. It's still kind of all over the place. And if you didn't like the Suspiria remake, this is probably going to fulfill what you wanted.
Wow, this is the Get Rich.
The beginning of our show.
We just spent the first part of the show talking about the Suspiria remake.
So it's like synchronicity.
What was the consensus on the Suspiria remake?
Well, we're going to hold off because Ryan isn't here and hasn't seen it.
And I haven't seen it tomorrow.
Rob hasn't seen it.
I thought it was we were both kind of still processing, liked, didn't quite love,
parts
different reaction.
Parts I loved, parts I didn't.
Joe and
love,
I are kind of on the same page as it being this kind of like Fassbender-esque kind
it's
of
way
story.
More Fassbender
it's
than
so
anything.
Much
it
more.
Even has Ingrid Cavan in it. Yeah, like, yeah. Jesus Christ.
And it's this conceit about like being this World War II kind of
that's
like.
That's what we were talking about. We were like, it's more of a political film,
it's
both within the Witch Studio, the Witch Studio, both within the witches themselves and the political battles and the political stuff happening outside. It's much more a political film.
But the one thing I did say is I think it's a really good witch film. I think as a witch films go, like if you look at other witch films, I'm like, this is a pretty damn good witch movie, forgetting that it was called Suspiria. It's like the witch stuff delivers, you know? Yeah. So for me, that's
we had a big
enough.
Discussion about how the gore is presented differently in it, whereas Argento kind of crafted it cinematically. This is much more like girl on the floor getting bones broken.
Hey, and then you guys should listen to this episode.
Yeah, you should listen to the first half.
Rather than repeating
we could do both.
Well, Tara will fulfill, if you were disappointed, Tara will fulfill that need that's for like another Suspiria. I also really like, and it's kind of a weirder one, which is, and we just put it out not too long ago.
When somebody from Vinegar Syndrome goes, it's a weirder one, you know, we are going on a trip here.
And the title is escaping me, Joe, and it's.
What's it about?
Oh, it is, I'm sorry, it's Cycles in Love.
Oh.
Cycles in Love, which was a rather recent one, which is kind of this
director it's disconnected.
Yeah, it's so cute. Huh. It's like, here's these two murderers who meet each other in New Jersey and are like, we both hate grapes. Let's sing and just kind of kill people together. And you're like, man, this is like a really enjoyable kind of like romantic comedy. And so when I have couples that come up to the table and they're like, hey, we're like a couple, I'm like, you guys see Cycles in Love. This is the movie that's going to make you get a tattoo together.
Wow. I love your sales pitches.
No, they're wonderful.
Because I'm looking, strip joint owner and manicurist find things in common.
Yeah.
And okay.
And there's a, yeah,
Cycles
it's
in Love.
It's great. And then the other one that I also really like, and I kind of sometimes like I'll put it on. My wife will kind of like look up from doing work, and she'll be like, "Is this a Joe movie? Did he put this out?" And I'll be like, "Yeah." And she goes, "I knew it."
Joe is all smiles right now.
Yeah, you can totally spot it when she just kind of makes that face like, "I know when he put this, what he did." And you look at some of them, and they're really, you know, and there's always – the one thing I'll say is that for every movie that Vinegar Syndrome comes out, there was a lot of effort put into it by the filmmaker.
Oh, yeah.
That whatever they were trying to do, whether or not they accomplished it, you can see the amount of energy and, like, ideas that they threw at the screen.
Sincerity. That's what I always say. Like, no matter how good or bad a certain movie is, you can tell a filmmaker's sincerity, that they were trying to make something good.
And I think that that's across all the films. I mean, certainly there are some where you can kind of question it at times, but it's always there. I also – one of the other ones I love was one of the earlier ones. We went to a screening of it, which was Mad Men.
I was going
to
say Mad Men is my top pick.
And that was a huge seller.
It is our top seller.
Yep.
And really?
Yeah.
Horror
beautiful
movies,
now.
And I remember we went to the screening together and we're sitting there. And I hadn't seen it. Maybe since I was like 8 or 9 years old, and I didn't really remember it that well. And watching it with Joe in the theater, I was just like, and then seeing it on the disc, it's like, wow, it looks exactly the same.
Yeah.
And if you have never seen it, or if you're just kind of like familiar, oh, it's a Cropsey movie, you know, it's probably just like a regular slasher, you know, and you're watching it again, you're really kind of taken by how it looks and the feel of that movie.
And the directing at certain things. Like there's a scene where he's in the background coming out and the camera kind of moves and I was just like, oh, this is directed. Like this feels like it's really put together, especially that last kind of act of it.
Yeah,
I was surprised by
and
that.
I mean, he looks cool. That's the thing.
I hadn't seen it till their release, actually.
Shot by the guy who shot Miss 45.
Oh, cool. Wow. It's one of my favorite movies.
Wait, what's the one where we see Ferrer's dick again? I don't want to forget that.
That's Nine Lives of a Wet Pussy.
Okay, I won't forget that time on. I will not forget that promise. A promise of Ferrer.
There would be no Abel Ferrara without Nine Lives.
Okay. Now, is true, Zoe Lund in it? Because I would do, like,
no. She's not one of those Nine Lives.
Okay, you lost me.
But it still is worth watching. I won't spoil it, but like I said, Abel Ferrara's dick is in it.
And he's wearing it. Don't oversell it. You got to the peak with the, what about, is there a hard one on your mind?
I'll give you a few.
Okay.
I'll echo Jeff's sentiments on Don't Answer the Phone. I'm really fond of that film. It's uniquely nasty. And I think that's always a good thing for a horror movie.
Like, they played the trailer for that. I think it was at Phil Blankenship's triple feature where he played Scream for Help, Linda, and Stepfather. Lisa, rather. I think they played that trailer, and I had never seen the film, and I was like, oh my God, it's a great trailer for it.
If the guy looks familiar, it's because it's Paulie from Darkman. That's how I always remember that guy.
Yeah. The bald guy?
Yeah.
I love that. When it's like that one guy from that one movie, and you're like, oh my God, he did another movie.
Yep.
And here it is.
And he's like the star of it. And it's, they're answering the phone, and it's just like, he's just the apartment that he's in, and just like when he comes into these women's homes, and they're just like, hey, you seem like a normal guy. He's like, yeah, I'm pretty normal. I'm sweaty, and I'm really excited. And they're just like, I'm just going to go ahead and go over here for a minute. He's just like,
all right, that's one.
Another Norman Warren film that we put out early this year called Prey.
Yeah.
We're going to cover for that one.
It's barely a horror movie in the conventional sense. It's basically about these two reclusive lesbians who find a guy who is actually a sort of fox shapeshifter alien.
He's a cat man.
Oh,
and he's...
And they basically... take him in, and there's a lot of like sexual tension between one of the women and him, but he just eventually just wants to eat them.
Oh, cool.
I sell that very easily. I said there's two lesbians and a cat man. Uh-huh. The cat man keeps killing people. The lesbians are just like, he's a cat man. It's all right. Look at him. And he's kind of like, he doesn't ever says anything.
Yeah.
Dude, he looks really creepy in this. Like when you said Catman, I picture something hilariously funny. This is actually, it's almost Martin-ish.
Yeah, it looks like a vampire.
It's like really terrifying.
It's a horror movie remake of The Fox, the Mark Rydell film with Keir DeLay. That's kind of forgotten now, but it was a big hit in the 60s. And yeah, I mean like...
Starring Anne Haywood of Good Luck, Miss Flycatcher.
Yes.
Originally given an X rating, does it get pretty extreme?
Well, in the UK...
Yeah. Oh, okay. Oh, well, they have everything in X rating. That doesn't count.
Okay.
But
our release does have an extra face-eating shot that was cut out of the previous release.
It says that 11 seconds of Anders eating a girl's face cut out of – yeah. So, well done. You got the face eating.
So another, which is a title that we're doing next year, which has a lot of commonalities with Prey, including the same lead actor playing basically the same role, called Corruption of Chris Miller, which is a movie directed by Javier Bardem's uncle, Juan Antonio Bardem.
Sal Bardem.
Starring Gene Seberg and Marisol.
Oh, wow. Okay.
This thing is kind of like a Spanish pseudo-giallo about these two women who live in a house and a strange man shows up, and maybe he's the local serial killer, maybe not.
Okay.
And what's it called again?
The Corruption of Chris Miller. We have it tentatively slated for next spring.
Okay.
And I'm very much looking forward to that one. It's one of the best kept secrets of Euro non-Italian jolly.
I'm having problems finding information about it online. So, yeah, it's...
Okay,
one more. I'm finding it under Italian titles. Very cool. Or Spanish
one
titles.
One more horror title.
Yeah.
One of our first Massage Parlor Murders.
Okay. I haven't seen that one, but I remember when that first came out.
It's one of my proudest.
I thought it was porn, so that's probably why I didn't get it.
It does not come with a bar of soap. I'm just going to tell you about Massage Parlor Murders. It should. Uh-huh. It does not. That's probably why it didn't sell as well.
Uh-huh.
It has, I think, Sandra Peabody of Last House on the Left in it. It's one of the women from
Last
House on
the Left. And George DaDonza.
Yeah, George DaDonza before The Deer Hunter.
Just kind of getting beat up.
Silly sequence, and Brother Theodore, if any of you know.
Oh, yeah.
Brother Theodore.
I've seen recently the one with Devil Express.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, he's preaching on the
basically,
corner.
Basically, yeah, he plays a preacher.
Yeah,
he was also in Nocturna, another one that's criminally underreleased.
I love that movie.
That movie starts out with 5 minutes of her walking.
I know. And you can tell that it's completely improvised because these people are coming up to her on the street and they're like, hey, baby, what you doing? And she's like, nothing. Just walking away from you. Like, the movie just keeps going as these real people are encountering her.
I do enjoy its throbbing disco soundtrack.
I own the record. It's brilliant because, like, Gloria Gaynor has songs on it. It's like a legit soundtrack.
Nighttime fantasy.
It's actually quite fun. No, I like that because of the disco stuff and that it is kind of an update. And plus, whenever they turn into bats, you get this amazing 80s, like, hand-drawn lightning graphic, which is pretty fun. And Brother Theodore's
in it. So I watched the other film that Nai Benet produced to star herself that she made right after Nocturna. And it is unfortunately interminably dull.
Oh, no.
But shot by a very, directed by a very good DP, Mac Alberg, who shot the House films. And it's just like this boring gangster movie where she's like the love interest. And it's just interminably boring.
About 10 years ago when I was still working at Fangoria, I wanted to do an article on Nocturna, and I tried to hunt her down to do an interview. And she's since moved back to the Middle East and doesn't talk to anybody or talk about her films. But one day I will find her. And
she's an interesting character.
Oh, you've met her before?
No, I'm just saying, like, she obviously is an interesting character considering these are the movies that she decided to make starring herself.
Yeah, and that they are so she was clearly trying to launch a career there, and why she chose these ones, like, there's some fascinating stuff there.
So in wrapping, anything that hasn't been, like, post-Incubus, have you announced any of the titles coming out right after this new slate?
Well, as hopefully some people will know, we have two surprise titles that are coming out on Black Friday, and they are both
surprises.
I was going to say, are you going to tell us? Do we get an exclusive?
when the microphones end, probably, but not before.
I'll tell you letters that are
guessing game.
Love Butcher. No, just a guess. No.
No.
Damn. I'm sure that was good.
You know, you should try this. Butcher. Because one of the greatest moments of Shockwave's history ever is when we had David Gregory from Severn on, and he's like, can you tell us what's coming out? And Elric randomly said out of nowhere, Cathy's Curse. And he's like, holy shit, we are putting that out.
It was totally random.
When we did, we had Mark Ramsey on for the Inside Psycho.
Yeah.
And we were asking, like, what's the next one you do? And I said, you guys should really do Jaws. And he just shoots me this look, and I'm like, oh shit.
Quite as random as Cathy's Curse.
Yeah, the Cathy's Curse.
And I think I was only thinking of it because of Brian. What's the least likely title
that anyone would ever put out? And you picked.
So I get one more guess. If I get it right, it's not Candy Statues.
I can't tell you. I can't. I'm not going to confirm or deny anything. You can guess one for next year.
After we finish.
But
this has become a tradition, right? Black Friday surprise titles. So talk a little bit about that.
Are one of them is one horror of the?
They're both horror.
Okay.
Both horror.
One of them was shot in 1970. The other one was shot in 1981.
Okay.
But that does not indicate when they came out.
That's actually very true. Neither one came out in its year of production.
We've played this game before, sir.
But, you know, I will say this. A lot of people on the Blu-ray forum have guessed at least one of them correctly.
Wow. Okay.
Interesting. Which one was that, and what's its title?
So the one that they did not guess, fewer have attempted to guess, is a one-word title that begins and ends with the same letter.
Oh.
Nope. Wow. Unless my spelling is wrong.
It's right.
I will give you one that we haven't announced, period, yet.
We got an exclusive?
For next year.
Let's hear it. Yeah,
David said that I should do that, so I'm doing it.
It gets pretty exciting for people.
I don't know how exciting this will be. Hopefully it will be. But we recently announced Uninvited, the Graydon Clark directed Killer Cat Monster on a Boat movie. So we're also putting out Wacko, which is his pre-scary movie slasher parody, which also happens to be the first film that Andrew Dice Clay was in.
Oh, wow. That sounds fun.
Okay, Wacko exclusive.
And a whole bunch of other really unexpected actors in supporting roles.
Okay, cool.
Somebody listening in their car just heard Wacko and literally his fist pumped the ground.
Hell yes, it is.
Wacko's coming to Blu-ray.
It's probably the same person who just hit your car. They're like, we're Wacko, and then hit your car.
Thank you.
There's a mom with a kid. She kicks ass.
Damn, Wacko.
Okay. It is kind of remarkable, though, like how similar it is to Scary Movie.
Okay.
Really?
Yeah. It's like a very sort of ham-fisted making fun of blatant slasher tropes.
Wait, has anyone put out the John Hawkes film, Scary Movie? The one in the...
Is that what it's called? Yes, I think so.
That John Hawkes with the little...
The early 90s Texas movie?
Yeah, that
one. No, that is.
Because that's another one Mike Williamson showed after. Yes. And that definitely felt like we were the only people ever seeing this movie.
I'm not putting it out.
Okay. Because you didn't like it, or because it's hard to put out?
No, for other reasons.
Okay. Yeah. Anyway, that was an interesting one.
Well, we want to move a lot of Runaway Nightmares tonight, guys. Yeah, so everyone go check out Runaway
DVD?
Nightmare.
Runaway Nightmare?
It was a Blu-ray limited edition. Now we have a standard DVD. So, yes.
I am going to be buying Good Luck, Miss Wyckoff. That's the one that
is
I'm doing. Catch My Soul, because as soon as you say unreleased musical, immediately I'm like, okay, I'm there. So, yeah, Catch My Soul.
All right.
And we also have Terror for everybody to go check out, which is the British Suspiria.
Cool.
Was that the one? Excellent. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you guys so much for joining us. And obviously, hit up vinegarsyndrome.com. You guys are on Facebook and social media.
Come to the conventions and say hi to us. I really want to push that. Yeah. Like, please, like, introduce yourself. Like, we love talking to people, whether it's me or Brandon or James or whoever. Come to the store, you know, in Connecticut if you're able to. I know that one of the things people would love to do is, I know people have asked us before about opening a store in Los Angeles. You know, people opening other stores, like people, they want to go to video stores. Yeah, they want to buy stuff and they want to interact. And I know that, especially here in LA, it's hard to find stores to actually interact with people and buy stuff at where the prices are decent.
Yeah.
So we really, at this point, please come to the conventions and like talk to us, and we will be happy to like discuss our titles with you or whatever. So, and even if you don't buy anything, we give out our catalogs, we give out our cards. Like, mm-hmm. we want people to be aware of what we do, because it only breeds more success down the road.
Yeah. 100%.
Cool.
So, thanks guys so much. And, we'll be back next week.
Yeah.
Thanks guys.